If you're a strong woman in my environment, you're a problem. So I'm a hell of a problem. I don't have time, an awful lot of time for hobbies, but keeping alive one of them.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID secure, very COVID secure this week, as we're all remotely. I'm actually in London. Martin's over in Herefordshire. And but the show is still streaming live from Bristol, from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 4th of June, 2021. So we're also on RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. The censorship and the self-censorship of life-saving information is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the media owner collaborators. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and we'll credit you here. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist, as ever, Martin Summers. In the second part, a new Israeli war government. Naftali Bennett, is he going to be worse than Netanyahu? Also, the Dr. Fauci, the damning emails. Lie after lie after lie. Why is he still in his job? Also, is the NHS going to make compulsory vaccination or masks, but particularly the vaccination? They're now talking about making that compulsory, and those that don't want to have it be getting sacked from their jobs, no matter how many decades of experience they've got. Also, interestingly, contrasted to that, half of the staff at the National Institute of Health in the United States have refused the vaccine. So how come everyone in the NHS has got to have it? Anyhow, there's also warnings about the spike protein from COVID being found in the bloodstream, which is a mistake. It's not supposed to be there. We look a little bit at the history too. Did the Rockefeller family, John D. Rockefeller specifically, create the Spanish flu? Really good article on Fort Russ about that. China paying its citizens to get vaxxed? Never mind having to pay for a vaccine. They're paying you. And also, of course, last weekend's freedom demonstration on Saturday, a report from that, which was not reported in the press, even though there are probably around about 100,000 people turned up, and also the storming of the Westfield shopping centre, which was reported in the press the next day. I think fascinating little action, but also Bilderberg 2021. Whatever happened to them? They're certainly big in the COVIDocracy. Their job has been done, is it? With the people all in power, are they now running the show? We hear from the American Free Press journalist, an erstwhile colleague of Bilderberg sleuth, Jim Tucker. So just because there's no news on Bilderberg doesn't mean to say we're not going to be talking about it. And his name is Mark Anderson. He'll be talking about this year's non-appearance of the Bilderbergs, and also a prosecution going on in the States of somebody that did attend the Bilderbergs. Also, Yemen, they're striking into Saudi Arabia this week, the Houthis. Two tankers, one called the Express Pearl in Sri Lanka, sinking, polluting. Another one called the FSO Safer, obviously not very safe, that one, in Yemen. That also considered to be about to explode, but then that may just be the UN Security Council making a fuss about nothing, who knows. Also blowing the whistle, former banker Ronald Bernard has some extraordinary experience to relate about the extent to which the super wealthy hedge funds determine who succeeds and who fails in the world of commerce. He was a former money launderer. And the Danes spying on the Germans for Washington, a story that Martin did for Russia Today. We also hear from Australian singer Alan Childs. His brave film, he and his family could be targeted now, about the influence of Freemasonry in the entertainment industry, and also, he says, in politics too. And finally, could a handful of people hold great sway over war and peace by steering our fate? Sent to jail and ridiculed as mad, Fritz Springmeier wrote Bloodlines of the Illuminati in the 1990s and then was jailed for not paying his taxes. On his release, there was even speculation that it wasn't the same person, but that was probably just a ruse to confuse, as the psychological warfare brigades say. Anyway, he runs through low-profile families and high-power families, what he believes is a multi-generational cult. We'll be hearing a clip from that as this week's conspiracy classics. But Martin, also, I mean, we're just talking there about he was going to jail for tax evasion. But this week we hear that the Microsoft firm that collects all the license fees for all the Microsoft products around the world that's based in Ireland hasn't paid a penny in tax. They're based in Ireland, but their tax base apparently is in Bermuda. So nobody, all this money that people are paying to use Microsoft products is just going straight to Microsoft. They're not paying any tax on it at all.
On the question of tax, obviously the wider mainstream discussion this week has been about Joe Biden's attempt to create a world minimum for corporation tax, which the British, of course, the French, the Germans, the Italians have all signed up for it. The EU is still a bit iffy about it because Cyprus and Ireland aren't keen. And, of course, Rishi Sunak's been put under pressure to sign up for it. And, of course, the British don't really like the idea, being as they are, you know, basically the tax havens, the Cayman Islands, etc., are, you know, an integral part of the City of London's business model.
Yeah, well, we got the Channel Islands, the Isle of Man.
Indeed, yeah. So and we've obviously got the G7 summit coming up in Cornwall. And, you know, there's going to be quite a lot of discussion because obviously Biden will be pushing what he wants to do. The French, the Germans, etc. will be agreeing with him. And it could be that Britain's out on a limb there because they'll be the one G7 member that isn't agreeing to it. So, and of course, we're really only talking about tip of the iceberg stuff here. But I mean, it is a kind of straw in the wind of kind of change of attitude towards tax evasion.
Well, it's certainly
about time, really.
I mean, you know, they would say it's tax avoidance, not tax evasion, because apparently it's legal. Do you want to have a guess at how much money they raked in? The Microsoft subsidiary in Ireland that paid no corporation tax last year, it's called Microsoft Round Island One, registered in Dublin. It collects the license fees from Microsoft's copyrighted software, and it's based in Bermuda. It's a tax resident in Bermuda, where companies are not charged any corporation tax.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what they're doing.
I mean, they're guess using all of these loopholes. How much they made?
I've no idea, Tony. Tell me.
I just want to see if it's profit or turnover. $315 billion.
Mm-hmm.
No tax.
Yeah, well, I mean,
That is profit, because imagine this is just a company that's just collecting the license fees. It's got no outlay virtually, and apparently no employees. But it made $315 billion in profit and paid not a penny in tax.
Well, I mean, the triaging between these different tax havens has become, you know, it's there's a massive amount of money stuck in there which can't be accessed by governments. And of course there's quite a lot of resistance by the governments which are complicit in this to keep the status quo as it is. But you know, at some point, as the crisis intensifies, governments, including the US government, are going to need resources. And, you know, ultimately, if the major economic powers get together, there's no reason why this money can't be taxed. But, you know, Delaware, which is where Biden is from, is a tax haven. That's loads of companies are registered in Delaware to avoid paying tax. Britain's a tax haven. I think it's the French and the Germans in particular who are keen to put a stop to this. But whether they'll have the power is another matter.
They've got most of their money in Luxembourg, haven't they?
And well, that's right. So, but at the same time, I think they regard this whole thing of putting taxes out of government control. I mean, they're talking about having a sort of register of all companies operating in the EU, what their turnover is, what taxes they pay in different jurisdictions, because it's fairly standard practice for multinational companies to engage in what's called transfer pricing, which means that they show all of their profits in no tax jurisdictions and all of their losses in places where the corporation tax is high. And, you know, there's no mechanism present to stop them doing that.
Ireland's entire GDP for 2020 was $357 billion, euros, and this is $315 billion made by a company in Ireland. But no, I mean, obviously, this, the other side to this, of course, is this is a Bill Gates little exercise here, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, the Irish
have how you can become the richest person in the world by avoiding paying tax.
So, you know, they bet the farm on doing exactly that. And it's quite, you know, even if they were to agree to change it, which I don't think they have, they would, you know, they would find themselves in difficulties because they rely on a lot of foreign direct investment in Ireland as a result of the fact that they don't charge high levels of corporation tax.
It seems to me everybody these days is reliant on the hedge funds and the big investors to come into the country, and they're kind of bribed to do it, you know, so they haven't really got any control much over their own. And these people know, don't they, that they will, as soon as somebody even so much as questions what they're doing, then they'll just up sticks and disappear to another country somewhere. So,
yeah, well, yeah, I mean, there are a number of big hedge funds like Blackstone in the US,
really,
which own virtually all multinational companies. So it's, you know, the target is getting very, very clear and juicy in a way.
I mean, people have been talking about Bill Gates saying, oh, well, he's stepped away from Microsoft. Well, of course, he hasn't given his shares away.
No, and of course, he's well known, but there are others out there doing pretty much the same things that were less well known. And Blackstone, of course, and other hedge funds have actually carried out a coup, as it were, inside, I think it's Gulf Oil or Chevron. So they're putting people in charge of oil companies who are in line with the Great Reset agenda.
Because
they have, you know, they own so much of the shares in these companies.
Well, if you own a certain amount of shares in a company, I think it's maybe around about 10% or something, 8% or 10%, you then get rights to nominate directors. And
that's what they've been doing. They've been putting essentially, you know, their own people in charge of these oil companies. And this is all part of, a general push for the Great Reset. So, I mean, you know, there's an awful lot going on out there. I mean, don't forget that the whole of the stock markets in the whole world is a massive bubble now. I mean, the money printing that's been going on since the start of the COVID crisis, it's just incredible. And the stock markets and British house prices, for example, the highest ever. And it's a classic bubble. And at some point, it's going to burst.
Yeah, like most bubbles do. Anyway, this is in the iPaper today. The iPaper is, the headline is Pennon. Ever heard of them?
Who?
Pennon. P-E-N-N-O-N.
What is that?
Well, good question. You haven't. Will supply Bristol with water. After an $814 million deal, the water firm Pennon takes on more than a million new customers as it expands into Bristol in an $814 million deal. They've agreed to buy the company behind Bristol Water from its US, European and Japanese owners. They haven't said who owns Pennon, though. Around 1.2 million people rely on Bristol Water for clean drinking water in and around the city. Attractive opportunities, they say, blah, blah, blah. But again, you know, this is just Bristol Water being shunted around amongst the super rich elite.
Yeah, well, Bristol Water has always been private. Wessex Water wasn't, of course, and they ended up as part of the Enron debacle some years ago. And, you know, what you have to think to yourself, well, what is the case for hedge funds to run the water supply? Where's the competition? How do you get competition into water supply? And, of course, in Wales, they have Welsh Water, which is a not-for-profit company providing water. And in Scotland, they've got Scottish Water, which is actually owned by the Scottish government. And, in Bristol, somebody, you know, some hedge fund in the US is going to be supplying us with water. It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
No, it doesn't make sense at all. It should all be run by people in the open so that everyone knows exactly what's doing. We had a whole load of Bristol Water people turn up in our street last week, dug it up, stuck something next to the hydrant in the road. I asked them, neighbours asked them, what are you doing? They said, we don't know. You have to phone up Bristol Water. I mean, this is they're like, it's like dealing with a cult. You know, this is around water. What the hell are they up to? They also destroyed the conduit that's been in the city centre, St. John's conduit, which has been that supplying Bristol with water for, now let me think, 450 years, built originally by the monks. And the Bristol Water did some water works in the city centre, and for the first time for 450 years, oh, it stopped flowing. Now, that was being used for fresh water during World War II in the bombing when the water mains had burst. And now it's all gone, thanks to good old Bristol Water. They love controlling that. Martin Ireland, I believe, has had a battle recently to try and keep water free, hasn't it? Because
during the aftermath of the financial crisis in 2008, they started to charge people for water for the first time. So up to that point, water had just been free. And of course, it was paid for. It was paid through the general taxation. And there was quite a lot of resistance to that. And when they tried to privatise the water supply in Bolivia some years ago, there was a huge pushback from the population. They were trying to sell people that they couldn't collect rainwater, for example. I mean, they're living in the barrios. They haven't, you know, they haven't got running water, and they're collecting their own rainwater. And they were told they couldn't do it; they'd have to buy it from the private company. I think it was Verizon, French company, and that led to a huge mobilisation, which ultimately led to Evo Morales becoming the president of Bolivia. And then just apropos of that, there's a very important election coming up in Peru this Sunday, where the left, I think it's called Carrillo, may win. And there's a right-wing, Fujimori's daughter, is standing against him. So the battle of, you know, the battle for power in Latin America continues apace. You know, there's been a big uprising in Colombia with loads of people killed. And in Mexico, they've got loads of elections coming up, and hundreds of election candidates have been killed mostly by gangsters. And, you know, they've got the presidential elections coming up in Brazil. Lula and Dilma Rousseff are back in play. And, you know, the whole situation is on a knife edge.
Well, yeah, we're getting away from water, aren't we, in Ireland?
I know, I'm just reminding myself of other things that are going on.
Let's try and keep it to that for the time being. In Ireland, the water charges were dropped after a vote in the Dáil, because there were a load of protests about it. This was in 2017, 4 years ago. They decided they're not going to do that. But, oh dear, guess what? The OECD is saying that they should start charging for water again, and they're trying to introduce a new way of doing that. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that excludes the people, obviously, says Ireland needs to step up measures on biodiversity and water to start charging for water. That would be good for the planet, apparently. What do you make of that argument, saying that you have to charge for water, otherwise people use too much of it?
Well, I think in Ireland, which, as you know, is a very watery place, the general view was you don't want to discourage people from using water because it keeps them clean, you know. And people have got used to the idea that they just turn the tap on, it came out. I think the real problems with water.
Well, we had that here, didn't we?
Yeah.
That got dropped when the rates went.
We meter water and so on, but in actual fact, if you think about it, if you are an isolated house in a rural area, the cost of supplying you water is far higher than supplying it to a tower block in the inner city. So there's no economic basis for charging people per litre of water. And that's what tends to happen. If you start metering, everybody gets charged the same amount. But in actual fact, the wealthy should pay more, because supplying individual detached houses is far more expensive than supplying people in a block. And ultimately, I think, you know, you've got to think of things like water, especially in countries like Britain, where we get a lot of water coming down on top of us, that it's a basic necessity that people should just be able to have.
The whole point here is that, you know, there's a principle being smashed down here with an iron fist. You don't get anything for nothing, not even water, even though, of course, it's there. God-given stuff just flowing around. We're not going to let you have it without you paying us and us shareholders making money out of it. The other thing,
that's right. If you're going to charge people, and of course most countries do, it ought to be on the basis of cost. there shouldn't be any profit made out
of it. The idea of, I mean, the old system, Martin, the old system was you just peg it to the rates, so whoever owns the house pays it. You're renting the house, you know, you don't pay a penny. Anyway, the other thing about all this is we talked a little bit about the nominating shareholders thing. This is something I found about the Bristol Water Company and also Wales and West Utilities, who were behind the big eviction of travellers a couple of weeks ago, is that all you need to do to see who owns the shares, it's not always easy to see, is to just look who's on the board. You find, for example, on the board of Bristol Water, Wessex Water and Wales and West Utilities, who are doing energy, that Wales and West Utilities do the gas and electricity, that they are, and particularly gas, I think, you find the merchant venturers on the board. So obviously the merchant venturers own massive tranches of shares in these people, and so they get to decide who's in charge. Now, what we've effectively done here is we've privatized these utilities, and these elites, these ancient societies, like the slave traders, basically, have snapped them up. They're now using us as slaves, because every time we turn on the light or use a drop of water to feed our kids or whatever, to drink of water for the children, they're taking their cut.
Yes, and ultimately, of course, the purpose for the reason why these things were put in the public sector in the first place, you know, it was often developed by, you know, city administrations developed things like gas and water supply. It was called gas and water socialism. And, you know, people never used to have it, and they provided it, and they provided it at cost. And what it did was subsidize the wages of ordinary people so that genuine entrepreneurs who were coming up with, you know, new stuff for the market, have actually got, you know, infrastructure provided at cost. But what's happened with the financialization of the economy since the 1980s is that massive amounts of money are made out of these infrastructural services. But that, of course, makes your real market economy sector that much less effective and efficient. And of course, countries like China, which have actually got public infrastructure in place and they haven't privatised it, then get a cost advantage over you.
Yeah. Also, of course, the other thing here is that people don't think about this, but if you want to invest, say, for example, around about £3,000 or £4,000 or £5,000 in shares for one of these public utilities, not only do you get a return on those shares, that effectively that return pays your bills. So you're not really paying any bills. You just put a bit of money into the company in order to, so that nobody's going to charge you anymore to use gas, electricity, water, or whatever that utility might be. So if you're wealthy, you pay nothing. If you're poor, you're paying for the wealthy.
Yeah. So it's basically redistributive from the poorer sections of the population to wealthier sections. But ultimately, of course, although this is very popular amongst those who've got asset rich, it basically means that your economy becomes increasingly ineffective and inefficient. I mean, that's the story of what's happened in the British economy in the last 40 years, is the financialization of the economy has basically allowed the infrastructure to be profiteered, and manufacturing industry has basically been hollowed out. And, you know, it ain't coming back anytime soon.
So there's no word for that, reverse taxation or something, where, you know, the poor get taxed. But
the phrase is whether taxation is progressive or regressive. Of course, taxation has increasingly become regressive. So, you know, people who are PAYE are paying a far higher proportion of their income in tax than people, you know, wealthy people who've putting it all in tax havens.
Well, it's like the Microsoft story we were hearing at the start. What we've got is the poor paying for the rich to have pay no tax.
Well, the tax burden has been gradually shifted. I mean, in the 1950s, the top rate of income tax, it was in the 90% plus in Britain and the US, fairly common. And it was as a result of the Second World War, really. And that's what allowed things like health service to be created. But you've now got a situation where Ireland, you know, the corporation tax is minimal. In this country, it's only 40%. And then people say, well, why? You know, we used to be able to afford all these things, but we can't afford them. And it's quite simple. You know, the asset-rich classes have liberated themselves from paying the levels of tax which were normal a generation ago.
Yeah, the interesting thing as well, of course, is so much of what companies do, they can write off against tax. So they're spending on advertising, all sorts of other things. They don't pay any tax. That's just written off. Martin, before we get too far into that one, another thing in the Eye today, the Eye paper, which I got a hold of a copy by Patrick Daly in there, households could be left paying more for less as council taxes rise while services are cut in response to the import of the impact of the pandemic. MPs have warned English councils face holes in their budgets due to over-optimism from the government about the impact of coronavirus. And ratepayers are having to pay an average of 4.3% extra 21-22 in council tax bills. Local Government Association has pressed ministers to meet all cost pressures and income losses incurred by councils. Meg Hillier, chairwoman of the Public Accounts Committee, called the government's approach very concerning. She said the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government's over-optimism about the impact of the pandemic on local authorities risks leading to reductions in services for local people. Council tax bills were rising by an average of 4.3% across England, meaning that local people will be paying more for less. So effectively, this is a ratchet system. It's a racket, really, isn't it? So the councils are saying, we're not going to do so much, but we're going to charge you more for it.
Yeah, well, most councils, most of their money used to come from the central government grant, depending upon their, you know, various social indicators in the country, in the regions concerned. And what the Tory government has done this time, as they've done in all previous crises, is that they just starve local government of funds. And it's very clear, for example, in the special needs sector where I work, local councils haven't got a budget for that. So when parents get a educational and health statement, local councils are resistant to paying it out because if they pay it out, they've got to cut something somewhere else. And of course, local councils in big cities and so on tend to be controlled by the opposition parties, the Labour Party in particular, and then they have to go around cutting all of their services that they provide. And of course, the people, the Tory government in central government, then hopes that the people are going to blame them rather than the central government.
What are we going to do about this? Because the rich, I mean, it was Kevin Cahill, wasn't it? He was on our programme a couple of years ago now, saying that he got a headline, the front page of the Sunday Times one week, saying the rich pay no tax. We can't carry on like this. It's like farming people, the idea that the poor have got to pay for the rich to have the life of Riley.
Well, it is. And ultimately, of course, the way it's justified is that this is efficient, that the people at the top are wealth creators.
Well, we know that's rubbish. We know that's rubbish. What are we going to do?
Well, ultimately, you've got to take political action to change it. And that involves changing things like the electoral system, which allows them to, which is basically designed.
Well,
it's not a bug, it's a feature. It's designed to prevent redistribution.
This is a cop-out, really. The Labour Party haven't been talking about this hardly at all. We've got Meg Hillier, that we just heard from her. But, the Labour Party should be banging the drum about this. They get a load of votes, but they don't bother.
Well, yeah, but the problem is that all that will happen under the current setup is that the poorer people who live in urban areas will, the Labour Party might increase their vote with those people, but it doesn't affect the marginals where elections are decided. Don't forget, I can stress this every week, in no other country in Europe would the Tory government be allowed to be the government. They've got only 43% of the vote. Recently, they've gone up to 44%. There's nothing, they would not be the government. In France, in Germany, in Ireland, any of our neighbouring countries, they wouldn't be the government. They would never have been the government.
Martin, you're living in a fantasy land, because if the Labour Party had supported Brexit at the last election, you might well have a Labour government.
Brexit was, to my mind, an enormous diversion.
Well, it wasn't.
That's what we should have been talking about.
This isn't what voters want to hear. The voters voted on Brexit.
They've now decided, after they've been bombarded with it, that Brexit is an issue. They didn't think it was an issue before it came along.
It's been a very divisive issue. But Martin, 2017 and 2019 elections were about Brexit because they weren't...
The vast majority of Labour voters voted to remain, Tony. There's a split within the Labour Party. North, some people in the Labour Party would not remain, but the vast majority
anyway,
were.
You know,
so there's no way that they were going to go for that, were they?
It's your faction's obsession with Remain, even though after the vote, which has sunk the Labour Party.
What's going to happen as we go
forward, right now.
As we go forward, Tony, did you see that there's a big trawler, state-of-the-art trawler, which is up in Hull, and we've failed to sign a deal to fish in Norwegian waters, and it's going to have to be scrapped, and 400 people are going to lose their jobs. And as we come out of this COVID crisis, it's going to become increasingly clear. I mean, the OECD has done a report which shows that Britain will have the most trouble coming out of this crisis precisely because of all these unsorted out problems that Brexit is going to throw at us.
All those stupid people that voted Brexit,
the IRC, which is unnecessary if we hadn't left the single market.
All those stupid people that voted Brexit, but they did, and you have to accept
that. Yes, but not in Scotland and not in Northern Ireland. So, in other words, we're going to move to a breakup of the British political system, a bit like the breakup of Yugoslavia or the breakup of the former Soviet Union.
You'd like to see any country.
Ask them in Ireland how peaceful that process is.
You'd like to see any part of the country that didn't vote for Brexit break away, just like the Northern Ireland broke away from Southern Ireland.
That's what's going to happen. And it's going to increase the political cost of investing in Britain. Foreign direct investment in Britain has collapsed. Nobody's investing.
I agree with the Brexit vote, Martin. You know, that's just the way you are.
By the way, Tony, as a pro-Brexiteer, are you in favour of the Australian trade deal? Yes or no?
It sunk your party, didn't it?
No, I'm just asking you as a Brexiteer.
And that's why you're not
going to
get elected.
Are you in favour of the Australian trade deal, Tony?
It's nothing to do with the electoral.
Liz Truss intends to have that deal signed by the end of next week with the G7 summit. You're pro-Brexit. Are you in favour of a trade deal with Australia? Yes or no?
What I'm in favour of is the Labour Party facing reality and actually looking at the voters
looking at the Northern Ireland protocol, the Šefčovič has been suggesting that what we could do to ease the tensions around that is if we just align our veterinary standards with the EU's veterinary standards, and they're already aligned, so it's quite straightforward. But the government in London do not want to do that because they want to do trade deals with Australia and the US, which means that we can't align our veterinary standards.
But it is boring, Martin.
That's why we have to have a
Brexit. This Brexit stuff is very boring, and that's why people
vote
for the Labour Party.
You've bored us with it over the years, Tony.
But
all the people who are pro-Brexit say they don't want to talk about it now, and we're just getting going because all the issues around Brexit are going to keep coming back again and again and again and again.
And that's why people voted Tory.
All over the planet. Yes or no, you do want to trade deal with Australia.
That's why people.
That's not what the National Farmers Union want, Tony. The National Farmers Union thinks it's a disaster.
That's why people voted Tory, not Labour, because it's poor.
Only 43%, 67% voted against. 67% of people at the last election voted for parties which called for a second referendum.
If you take your voters for granted.
If there's a second referendum tomorrow, Tony, you might not win.
If you take your voters for granted,
well, if there's going to be a breakup of the country and we're going to be signing all these controversial trade deals, I would argue we shouldn't try trade deals with anybody. If we're going to have sovereignty, that means no trade deals. We should leave the World Trade Organization. China was never in the World Trade Organization.
That's the sort of argument that lost.
And then we could nationalise everything and we could have a totally autarkic economy.
Martin, that's the sort of argument that lost you the election.
No, I think you've got to recognise, Tony, that this debate isn't over. It's certainly not over in Northern Ireland, it's not over in Scotland, and it's not even over in the major cities where most people voted Remain. We're fed up with being told that we've got to suck Brexit up. We're not necessarily going to suck it up. The people who didn't like the EU went on for years and years and years about not liking the EU. We don't like Brexit.
If you ignore democratic votes, your party
If you ignore democratic, this is not a democratic system, Tony. 43% of the vote shouldn't have an 80-seat majority in this country. It's a cause for civil war, this kind of thing.
Yeah,
and it was a civil war in Ireland about exactly this kind of thing.
Well, maybe. At the end of the day, you lost the vote and you wouldn't admit it.
No, Tony. We could have had another vote and we might have won it. If you have a vote in Switzerland,
referendums
are not actually in the British Constitution.
Until you get the vote you want.
Not in the Constitution, Tony.
You keep going until you get the result you want.
No, we don't have to accept. Nothing in a referendum or an election means that those who lose have to accept. We accept that we lost that vote.
Well, that's what happened in Belarus.
We have to accept that it's all over and we don't have the end of it. In Scotland, they are going to vote
in Belarus.
They probably to leave the United Kingdom over precisely this issue.
Martin, the Belarus, they didn't accept the election and they had massive street protests, didn't
they? Indeed. And what we need in this country, if the Labour Party starts aligning with the other opposition parties and we come to another election in 2023, as looks like it's going to be, and if we all say that we want to change the electoral system, and then if the Tories squeak home on 43% of the vote, we can say we're not accepting the result and we go to the streets. That's what's going to happen. And don't forget, by this stage...
Well, I think that's a fantasy. It's a fantasy.
Because of the deal with the Australians.
That is, I think, a fantasy. But wish you the best of luck.
I'm just pointing out the way forward, Tony. Yeah. There's going to be an awful lot of ill feeling about all of this.
There obviously is.
We could have stayed in the single market in the customs union, and we wouldn't have had any problem.
If you don't...
We chose to go for broke.
If you don't accept the vote, the result of a vote, then of course there's going to be problems.
Well,
we
could have had a second referendum. If we had a decent European-style electoral system in Britain, we would have had 67% of people voting for a second referendum. We'd have had a second referendum, and then we'd probably cancel the whole bloody thing.
Then you'd have lost.
No. Well, yeah. You think so, Tony. You would have to see, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, we're
doing Brexit now, and we are going to have a deal with it with the Australians. And you said you did want to deal with the Australians. Well, that means you are basically opening British farming up to being destroyed. And
no, of course, I didn't.
Particularly
I didn't say anything about it. I actually
Wales,
don't know
where the marginal
about,
farmers farm.
The
we're going to
deal,
the
Martin. I'd be happy for you to enlighten us all about it, but I don't know anything about it, I'm afraid, and so I didn't.
The problem is, Tony, that but people who voted for Brexit didn't know anything about it either. They thought they could have Brexit with no borders, and if we're going to sign trade deals with other people, it wouldn't be necessarily against our interests. We shouldn't be signing any trade deals with anybody, should we?
Anyway, at the end of the day,
one of the things in this Australian trade deal is that companies will be allowed to sue the government for loss of earnings if they pass any legislation which causes them to lose money.
Yeah, well, this is the sort of thing that the Europeans are trying.
Exactly the sort of thing that's in all of these trade treaties. Now,
yeah,
I don't.
Well, let's hope it gets rejected like the other ones did.
Well, in other words, anyway, we should be out on the streets now saying we don't want an Australian trade deal, but you say you do want one.
Well, look, I didn't say that at all. I haven't said anything about it.
A minute ago, you said you wanted one.
No, I didn't.
I asked you, and you said you did.
But I didn't answer you,
did
I?
Oh, you don't.
Well, I didn't say I wanted one.
The point of Brexit if we're not going to do trade deals with Australia.
Martin, I didn't say whether I wanted one or not because I don't know what's in it.
Ah, so in other words... What's happening now, Liz Truss, on behalf of the Tory government, which has got 43% of the vote and a majority of 80, is going to sign up for this trade deal. You don't know what's in it, and that's the result of your Brexit.
Well, we shall see. The result of all of this, I know you want to go on about Brexit forever, but the result of all this...
No, I want to bring it up because you want to bury it. We went on about Brexit for years and years when I really didn't want to talk about it. I thought it was a waste of time.
We talked about it.
Now we've got it, we're going to
talk about it until the cows come home, Martin. The idea that we haven't talked about it is ridiculous. Anyway, the result of all of this, as I was trying to say before you interrupted there, was that we've got lots of people now in Bristol who are very poor and they can't earn the wages to carry on and literally pay the rent and pay all the utility bills, etc. And just this morning there were enormous moves to evict people from squats. Now this is a symptom, I suppose, of the complete collapse of the economy. Is that you've got the High Street in Bristol, which is right up by St Nicholas Market, was once one of the proud great streets of the city. Almost all of the shops there are empty and they've been moved into by squatters. Riot police moved into evict squatters in Bristol, says the Bristol Post. A huge operation involved. 150 riot police this morning moved in. But the only thing is that the squatters had all left last night, so there was nobody to evict. So they had 150 riot police with nothing to do, basically. So what did they do? Rather than go home, they decided to go down to the Salvation Army in Bedminster and try and find some people they wanted to arrest anyway. I don't know. I mean, speaking to various people who were down there on the scene, they were smashing their way in and people were going up on the roof. Around about 3 or 4 o'clock this afternoon, the police finally went home. I mean, they made themselves look rather silly by having these massive load of riot police for absolutely nothing, Martin, basically for a simple eviction.
Well, you can see that we've got these various bills going through Parliament, the police and crime bill and all the rest of it. And younger people in particular are going to be hit very hard by the crisis that's coming. They can't afford
rent. Well, they are being.
They can't afford to pay the rent, and lots of people in private rented accommodation are going to start being evicted. And of course, the furlough scheme is going to run out soon enough. And, you know, the economy's on a knife edge. They're printing loads of money, which is making asset prices rise. But that could lead to, you know, basically inflation at the top end. But people at the bottom end are finding that their you know, livelihood is being destroyed if they're working in things like hospitality or whatever. And they can't afford the rent.
Well, and of course,
there's going to be confrontations between young people and the police, aren't there?
The idea of 150 riot police turning up to evict 20 people who walked out peacefully anyway because they didn't want to get arrested anyway or anything today, it just shows how unintelligent the police are. But there's another side.
I think that after what's happened with the Kill the Bill protests, they are nervous that they're going to be resisted, and they're possibly right to be nervous.
The point here being that we've got the Kill the Bill thing coming along, Priti Patel's police state bill coming, which is going to criminalise something like 100,000 people, travellers and squatters, across the country. And the idea, of course, is that you're not allowed to spend the night without paying somebody, and if you do, you're going to be put in jail for it. The point being really that this is before this bill's even passed, the police are starting to flex their muscles.
Yes.
Right, we're going to be tearing anyone that's not paid to stay overnight, a squatter or a traveller, off their site and throwing them in jail.
Well, as you know, historically, squatting was a civil, not a criminal offence, and people could squat provided the place was empty and the owners had to go to court to gain possession of it.
Well, that's right. And
the police weren't directly involved at all.
Well, it means that the landowners, the landlords, don't pay anything. They just phone the police up. The police do it all for them.
Yes, and this is part of the authoritarian mindset of the current government.
This is actually like the United States because it's trespasses.
Well, in the United States, you've got massive, homeless shanty towns springing up all over the place, just like the 1930s. And, you know, the attempt to criminalise that in Britain will be hopeless because if people haven't got any money and they've got nowhere to live, they're going to go somewhere, aren't they? They can't get round it. And
it seems to me that they're actually trying to create, you know, you were talking about a different sort of civil war, but here, if you're trying to criminalise 100,000 people, you're almost asking for a civil war.
Yes. And I imagine, given the other things that we've discussed over the years, that the deep state is quite happy to see that confrontation develop because then they will militarize it in such a way as to control the population before the next phase of the crisis. And, you know, it's happening at a molecular level. You know, people are hurting all the way down to the bottom.
So the eviction this morning, well, it wasn't really an eviction because there was nobody in there. On High Street this morning, the police used something called a closure order. They said there was antisocial behaviour going on, and they managed to get that through the courts. And so they used basically criminalised the people who were in there. And I've no idea what happened in court, so I wasn't in court. But a lot of these, Martin, the same people who were involved in the toppling of the Colston statue, the people who are quite political, radicalised in the city. And we've also heard this week that the Colston statue is now back on display, but it's lying down. It won't stand up.
Yeah, well, I mean, Bristol is getting a reputation around the world as a sort of place where demonstrations take place. And as, has been pointed out, people come in from the local district to join in. And the police in Bristol, no doubt, are, you know, looking at their options about what it is they're going to be doing, how they're going to deal with this, you know, wave of demonstrations which is undoubtedly going to be taking place. And, the cities like Bristol, where you've got a sort of Green and Labour political situation, you know, they're the dominant forces now. They're moving in a very different direction than other parts of the country.
Yeah, I was speaking to somebody from one of the traveller support groups a few weeks ago, and they said, well, it's like Bristol's on the front line here.
Yeah, well, don't forget the house prices in Bristol are particularly bad. You know, London is probably worse, but Bristol's not far behind in terms of difficulty of getting anywhere decent to live. And, you know, that overwhelmingly affects younger people.
Also, another bit of news this week is we've got a new Concorde, apparently. Have you heard that one, Martin?
No.
Yeah, it's called the Boom Overture. It's slower than Concorde. It's smaller than Concorde. But the Americans always hated it, Concorde, didn't they? I mean, it's obviously it's a very Bristol thing, the first flight in Bristol. And but this thing is coming back. I mean, I've been talking over the years. I think it was Oliver Dowden, is it? Oh, I'm not sure of his second name, that used to run the Bristol Aviation Museum when it was out looking for a new premises before it moved into its new home. And he was absolutely adamant. He said, well, we knew, he was one of the people working there, that the Americans were out to get us and they hated what we were doing. Why is it that the Americans hated Concorde so much?
Well, Concorde was it was a public sector. It was British aerospace and the French, wasn't it, coming together to build it. And that, of course,
Aerospatiale, the French.
Yeah, so in other words, these are two public companies. So the Americans don't like the idea of public companies at all. I mean, what they do is they subsidize Boeing by buying lots of weaponry from them. And of course, that then gives Boeing the resources to develop civilian stuff. So they didn't like the whole idea of you know, state enterprises.
Well, yes, an aircraft like the 737 MAX, that the pilots can't actually control it. It just crashes into the sea.
Yeah. And of course, wonderful as Concorde was, it was a fundamental misconception of the market. It was basically a white elephant because it was very fast flying across the Atlantic. And that was its unique selling proposition. But they couldn't actually get a lot of people in it. So the vision of it when it was that, you know, jet travel was going to be very, very elite, and some business people would want to travel very fast across the Atlantic. Whereas, of course, the Americans, too, you know, they basically read the market better, and you build big, wide-bodied, slow planes so you can pack them in. And that ultimately was, you know, was a more sensible way to go. And that's why Concorde, you know, wonderful as it, yeah, as it appears
it was
to be.
I mean, it was quite nice to see that work. The use of the military technology developed during and after the Second World War into something which was a peaceful use. Why did the Concorde crash, though? I've had a little look into this, and there's some fantastic... I mean, there's lots of nonsense written about why that Concorde crashed in 2000 in France. It was overloaded, number one. I mean, the pilot should never have taken it off because it's against the rules to take off a plane when it's overloaded. But Pete Finlay... Finlay, he was the chief flight engineer for the British Airways Concorde fleet, and he did a book called The Concorde Lectures, which is quite difficult to get hold of. I don't know if you can get hold of it anymore, but he explained that the British were doing a very good job in maintaining their Concordes, but the French weren't. The French were scrimping. Air France were... you know, they didn't really want to spend the money maintaining the aircraft. And so the French fleet was actually a bit ragtag and rough around the edges, whereas the British fleet was OK. But of course, after the crash, they decided, well, we're going to have to pull this out of service anyway, even though it was actually turning a bit of a profit at some points. And the main aspect here is that you've got a big company like British Airways that can afford to spend a bit extra on Concorde from time to time because it's got a massive fleet of other, you know, more bog standard aircraft.
Well, yes, but I mean, the fundamental point remains that Concorde really wasn't designed correctly with the market that it was going to enter into in mind. I mean, you say it was overloaded. Well, that's because it's too small. I mean,
you just don't load. You know.
Well, I know, but the point is, the reason why it wasn't viable and it didn't make money is you couldn't get enough people on it.
Martin, if the captain says it's overloaded, right? If he's told it's overloaded, he should just refuse to even taxi the thing.
Yes, I know, but the point is, the point is about Concorde, it was overloaded at fairly low level because it's
some of this baggage and some of this baggage off before we take off, and that was what you'd have to do. Anyway,
but in other words, he's not following standard operating procedure there because the plane's not big enough to make money, and that's why ultimately.
Well, I think it's much more that they were trying to squeeze more money out of it as these.
Well, yes, but what you're trying to do is sweep the asset, and you know once you've got it, as long as you're getting some money in from it, you've already invested in it. You know, you got the money, you might as well run it for a while. but ultimately it's not viable because, you know, the conceptual idea behind it missed the point, which is that basically mass air travel requires big aircraft, not fast, small ones.
Any more on Protasevich this week? It's a fascinating story.
Well, he's apparently this morning, I was told, he appeared on Belarusian TV, and he'd obviously been beaten up, and he gave an hour-long confession about how he was sorry about everything and Lukashenko was a great guy and all the rest of it. So...
this is a bit of a silly move by...
Well, it is. I mean, it's absolutely bonkers. I mean, from a public relations point of view, I can't imagine what was going through the minds of the people in charge. It's totally silly. And as we saw last week...
Well, they're thugs and
bullies.
Last
week, in the West, everybody believes that Lukashenko forced the plane down, whereas in actual fact, it was the Ryanair air crew that made the decision to land at Minsk. And then when they checked it for bombs, they discovered that this guy was on board and they'd already got a warrant for his arrest. So they arrested him. And it looks as if the source of the bomb warning was in Switzerland. And it looks as if it wasn't Lukashenko's people who gave the bomb warning. It was supposedly Hamas. Hamas immediately when they were notified. So it was nothing to do with us. But it was a genuine bomb warning, and it went to Vilnius and it went to Minsk. And the decisions were made by the aircrew to land in Minsk because the bomb threat said that we will blow this plane up over Vilnius, which implied that it might be a GPS bomb, you know, so that it would only blow up over Vilnius. So that's why they decided to go to Minsk instead. Now, at that point, Protasevich is on the plane. He's arrested with his girlfriend. I suspect that he may have been sacrificed by the people who gave the bomb warning in order to try and make Lukashenko look bad. And then Lukashenko stupidly, I mean, he should have basically just let him go, in my view. But once you've arrested him, to beat him up and then make him confess on camera, just is hopeless PR, hopeless. I can imagine the Russians are going nuts.
Yeah, well, they're just thugs and bullies, aren't they?
Well, they are, but Lukashenko probably won the election. The West doesn't seem to have grasped that. But on the other hand, he's basically, his attitude towards those who are opposed to him is totally negative. I mean, you feel like saying to him, look, you've won the election. You're the president. Why are you upset about all these people complaining about it? They're not going to overturn it, are they? You're not going to let them overturn it. So you might as well just let them march about and protest. There was once they were talking about having a general strike, and that never got off the ground because most of the big factories in Minsk, the workers voted for Lukashenko, and they know very well that if the opposition came to power, the first thing they'd do is close those factories. And this isn't well understood in the West. But nevertheless, I don't think what's happened here, Protasevich was not just a journalist. He'd been a volunteer fighting in the Azov battalion in the Ukrainian war, and he'd been wounded. So he's a far right militant.
I noticed his photograph.
And beating him up and, Martin, and making him Martin, confess is just silly.
Martin, his photograph was also used on the front cover of Black Sun, which is a Nazi symbol, as a recruitment guy.
Yes. So you can imagine that the KGB in Belarus don't like him, and they think he's a Nazi, etc., etc. All of which may be true. But the present, you know, this is basically falling into the trap. It's possibly a trap that's been set for Lukashenko by the Ukrainian intelligence.
Yeah, it's looking more a bit. Maybe you were right last week. Maybe a bit more because, you know, this video is completely going to backfire.
Yes.
Probably domestically too.
Well, I suppose domestically you could argue that people will look at this and say, oh, gosh, I'm not going to cross Lukashenko.
Look, well, yeah, but I mean, they'll also look at it and think,
but,
well,
I mean, in terms who's, of, who's I mean, the we've, bad got the Biden, guy we've got the Biden-Putin meeting coming up in Vienna, and, you know, both sides are at daggers drawn, really. There's all sorts of, you know, the provocations and, you know, reasons to disagree about all sorts of different things. And Yes, it's a very tense moment in international affairs.
Yeah, but this is going to blow over, surely.
Well, what it does is it's going to, ultimately, I think what Putin is talking to Lukashenko about is having a referendum, coming back to referendums again, in Belarus about Belarus returning to the Russian Federation. Because if that happens, then there's no prospect of a pro-Western government emerging in Minsk, because they'd be outvoted as one region of Russia.
Yeah, well, you say Vienna. I think you could be wrong about that. It looks as if they're going to be in Geneva, isn't it? In 2 weeks' time.
Well, I thought it was in Vienna. Maybe I'm wrong, but it may not happen. I mean, there's such a lot of shouting and bad blood that it may just be cancelled.
Well,
the Swiss authorities. That's right. So it must be in Geneva. The Swiss authorities were saying that they won't recognise people who've been vaccinated with the Sputnik vaccine. Because the Russian delegation have all been vaccinated with the Sputnik vaccine, but they won't allow them into Switzerland because they don't recognise that as a vaccination.
This is schoolboy, it's playground.
Well, that's the level we're on, yeah?
Yeah, so how pathetic. And also, what if you've had COVID? You don't need a vaccine.
Well, that's another issue. But I'm just saying
we're being insulted. Our intelligence is being insulted all the time by these imbeciles.
Yes. And, underlying all of this, it could well be, I mean, I know we're nearly at 6 o'clock coming up in a minute, and moving on to COVID. If this COVID is a bioweapon and actually deliberately released in China, then we're already well into the second round of World War III, aren't we?
Well, yeah, I think if a shooting World War III was to start, you know, I do like that Frankovich guy. Who was the fascist that he interviewed, Alan Frankovich, in the Gladio films?
Which fascist? He interviewed several.
Yeah, he interviewed an Italian, Vincenzo Vinciguerra, wasn't it?
Vinciguerra, yeah.
And he said is that in 1945, World War II finished and World War III began. And I kind of agree with that. Although, of course, it's not necessarily a shooting war. It's much more of a using every other method apart from that. Although, of course, there is...
Well, no, shooting as well.
Well, yeah, both.
It's just not generalised.
Is that what we call hybrid war? What's going on?
Yes, I mean, that's what's going on. I mean, everything that's happened since 20 years since 9/11 this September, and really the whole world has been in at war since then.
It has.
Attack.
Well, what he said in the Frankovich film is it's been going on since 1945, but just ramping slowly up like boiling frogs.
Yeah.
We've got biological warfare, as you mentioned. We've got economic warfare we're going on. Cyber warfare, it's almost everything.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Russians are being routinely blamed for the cyber attacks on oil industry and the meatpacking industry in the US. I mean, you feel so. Well, what possible motive could the Russians have for trying to stop the Americans getting their sausages? And it could well be that these attacks in the US are being carried out by the US deep state in order to create a casus belli with the Russians.
Well, that's right. And in fact, it's well known that it's impossible to tell where a cyber attack has come from.
That's right.
It's very easy to make it. And yet the US is and the Brits are even now saying that, well, we won't nuke you if you cyber attack us, even though we don't know who did it.
Yes. And of course, why would the Russians do, you know, nitpicking little cyber attacks? I mean, if you're going to have a cyber attack and you're as a warfare thing, you'd just go all out, wouldn't you? So, the world is, there's an awful lot of people creating conflict and tension out there. And, they're paid good salaries to do it.
OK, well, anyway, you're quite right. It's just coming up to 6 o'clock now. And we're going to have some music, a little bit of 14th century English sacred music, followed by an anonymous Swallow the Hogwash singer and Funboy 3.
Sing cuckoo, no, sing cuckoo, sing cuckoo, no, sing cuckoo.
Summer is a coming in, so just sing Saved. Swallow the hogwash. Go to your room. If you are sad, do it on Zoom. Swallow the hogwash from the CCP, the WEF and the WHO, the CDC. Swallow the hogwash from the BBC, FBYT, the powers that be. Swallow the hogwash. Wear a mask, you can probably talk out of your arse. Swallow the hogwash, take a shot. Bank balance and shitty, will probably not. Swallow the hogwash, it clears the brain of critical thought, but it keeps you sane. Swallow the hogwash, it's absurd, but you won't get abuse if you follow the herd. Swallow the hogwash, don't protest, unless it's approved, it'll warrant arrest. Swallow the hogwash, do as you're told, you're gonna be bought, you better be sold. Swallow the hogwash from billionaires, or you'll depress their stocks and shares. Swallow the hogwash, give up your rights, give up your loves, put out your lights. Swallow the hogwash, the point is gone of keeping calm or carrying on.
What's your name?
Easy to run by.
What's live on the farm.
What do you do?
We plant wheat. We gotta do what we do, cause we can't draw a dough. We've gotta earn a living. But every time the drugs were coming in June, bang goes another week's wages, bang goes another week's food. Policeman come.
What did they do?
They make a raid.
What did you do?
We stood still.
What did they do?
They drove away. We tried to sleep in the fields to protect our weed. We've got to earn a living. But when the lawsuit down and took away our weed, bang went another week's wages. Bang went our family's feed.
Policeman on the fiddle. He sold off the drugs to the man in the middle. He put it on a plane for Heathrow Central. It was picked up by a hippie in a Hertz car rental. Drove it into town and split it up in parcels. Sold it to his friends at an ethnic party. They talked about life but missed all the points, 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 points. They sat cross-legged and passed around the joints, and they inhaled the West Indian export. They talked about life but missed all the points, 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 points.
While back at the farm, we're still working hard. We've got deadlines to meet. We're rushed off our feet. We got to replant the fields. It takes 9 months to grow, and we got to earn a living. But if the crops don't show, we're gonna starve. Bang goes another year's wages. Goodbye to life on the farm.
Well, I'd very much like to welcome to the programme Dr. Stanley Laham from, I think you're in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, aren't you, Stanley?
Yes, close enough.
Okay, well, near Fort Lauderdale anyway. So could you just tell us a little bit about your career in immunology?
My career in immunology is that I received my doctorate from the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida, which is the flagship university of the state of Florida. I received my PhD from the College of Medicine, from the Department of Immunology and Molecular Genetics, which is what it is called now. It used to be Immunology and Infectious Diseases. My doctoral dissertation involved the discovery of a new virus, retrovirus, of the family Retroviridae, same type of virus as the AIDS virus, same family. And that is my expertise in immunology and medical microbiology.
Now, we've spoken to you several times over the last few years, actually, Stanley. Over the last few months. And the reason I thought it'd be nice to have you on live this week is because I've had the most extraordinary sort of attacks on my YouTube channel by YouTube itself, saying that you keep giving medical misinformation.
I'd very much like to know what is that medical misinformation.
Well, it's not always easy to tell with YouTube. They're a bit cheeky. And what they do is they just say, oh, we've taken it down for medical information. And you have to go through their list and find out what it is you've been talking about that might have crossed the lines. Now, the most striking one was when we were discussing recently the failure of the flu vaccine and the beginnings of an indication that it really wasn't working. So obviously I think it'd be great to hear, since that has been censored now, what point you were making there.
No, the point I was very simple, that there is no correlation year by year from 2020, from the flu season, there's no correlation between the number, the percentage of vaccinated people, and a corresponding lowering of the flu epidemic of people who caught the flu. The numbers do not correlate. For example, the lowest year was the 2011-2012 flu season. The number of vaccinated people in the United States, the percentage keeps going up every year. Yet we saw spikes in 2014 and a huge spike in 2017, when there were many more people vaccinated against the flu vaccine than in 2010. Yet in 2017, there were four times the number of morbidity and mortality than in 2010. That's what I was pointing out. Whether it's due to the ineffectiveness of the flu vaccine or a new variant that they were not prepared for, that the vaccine that they had prepared for the 2017-2018 flu season did not protect against the variant that actually came out. So, in general, one cannot say that the vaccination program, the flu vaccination program in the United States, has shown positive results. And I am talking, the statistics I get are from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. They're not mysterious sources.
Okay, so I looked at there's nothing about that the terms and conditions at YouTube say anything about. They do say a lot about the COVID vaccines, but they don't say anything about the flu vaccine, yet we were discussing the flu vaccine.
Well, I'm not privy to the decisions of YouTube or the people who make the decisions for YouTube. But there is nothing extraordinary about what I said, because, like I said, it is common. Anybody can find those out by looking at the statistics for the flu seasons from 2010 to 2019.
Well, okay. So, well, I'm happy to share that with our listeners. If you can send me a link, Stanley, I'll make sure the listeners can have a look at that and double check it too, because it's quite important as to whether a vaccine actually works or not. Seems to me quite an important thing. But anyway, what we're talking about here is the social media. Much of the mass media is blocking people like Stanley from even having a say, although most of us were brought up with the idea that it's quite healthy to have a second opinion, not to just have Dr. Fauci dictating terms as to what we can and cannot treat and how we should treat everything. Or in this country, SAGE and NERVTAG, these organizations, and we're going to be hearing a little bit about Jeremy Farrar later, who's the boss of he's from the Wellcome Foundation, the boss of SAGE here in the UK, who's been ignoring all the doctors calling for the use of ivermectin, for example. So let's have a listen now to it. We've had a report saying that half of the National Institute for Health staff in over there in the US, Stanley, have refused to have a vaccine.
Well, first, let me clear something about the flu vaccine. I'm not recommending that people either take the flu vaccine or not take the flu vaccine. What I am observing are simply very easily obtained statistics from cdc.gov and research the flu, you know, the statistics for the flu from 2010 to 2019. Anybody with access to the internet can see what I'm talking about the lack of correlation between the increase in vaccination and a decrease in flu incidence. Now, concerning the COVID-19, the corona, SARS-CoV-2 virus, what was your question?
Well, the National Institute of Health, half of their staff have decided they don't want a vaccine.
Well, And I'm finding that a lot of people are not trying, are waiting before they take an mRNA vaccine because it's a new type of vaccine. It's the injection of a messenger, a piece of messenger RNA into your muscle, which theoretically should just remain there, but one doesn't know if it might circulate in the blood and get picked up by other cells, such as hepatic cells or pulmonary cells. And these cells start producing viral antigen, causing an autoimmune reaction against the organs which would pick it up, which would pick up that piece of mRNA. The final studies, the third phase studies, have not been complete. And example for the Pfizer vaccine, they will not be completed and Moderna until mid 2022. So I can understand that some people are, you know, have their doubts about taking the vaccine right now and are waiting for more results from the third phase study.
Well, that is, yeah, it's basically people don't want to be part of an experiment, I suppose. But it is rather concerning that the organisation, the NIH, that's supposed to be so in the know about all this, don't want to touch these things with a barge pole. Well, they obviously some of them have had it, but certainly not all. Anyway, I think we're ready to go back to Tonya Buxton now, who's going to give us a 5-minute report from the march here in Bristol, in Britain, on Saturday in London. We had hundreds of thousands of people, but the BBC and ITV completely ignored it. So she also looks here at why it is that the press is acting in the way it is.
Personally, this is my opinion, not Talk Radio's opinion, but I do think we all have to follow what Lord Thompson said, that if by the 21st of June we are not all free, and it's that we must start gently doing what we feel in our conscience, yes, is right, and that might not be necessarily law-abiding, but we have to stop following laws that are silly and wrong,
yeah,
because these laws have been brought in emergency status, and who's to say that they're right? They're wrong.
But also, does anyone actually know what the laws are? Because I don't think many people do. I mean, somebody asked me the other day, how many people can you have in your garden? I don't know.
No, I don't.
But I'll tell you what, if I want to have some people in my garden, they're coming to my garden. Same goes for, you know, if you go out. How many people are you allowed to have at a table? Well, supposedly 6. Well, can you have 2 tables? People are ringing up pubs and restaurants, yeah, and basically telling them lies so they can go out with 12 people. That's going on.
But hang on, in my family, there's 8 of us.
Right.
So if there's only, this is what we had the last time when it's a table of 6, you know, who do I leave home?
Yeah.
If I go out for dinner?
But if that's your household, you can have all of them.
That's my household.
But then you can have all of them.
No, you couldn't the last lockdown. Didn't matter if it was one household.
Right.
This time you can have all of them. But
right,
the last time you had to choose 6.
Yeah.
It's all bonkers. I just can't take the no logic, no science.
Yeah.
There is no real grounds for any of these things going on. We must just stop. It's freedom for all. We must all open up completely now. There is absolutely no excuse for any form of measures. And as I said to you last week, anyone who's wearing a mask after the 21st of June must hate the planet.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you, though, those single-use masks, those plastic masks, are killing the ocean. 1.94 billion are worn a day.
Yeah.
Okay, so nearly 2 billion
and
are
also,
worn
if you
a day.
Are
a
wearing
week,
a mask,
sorry, a week
if
in the
you're
world.
Wearing a mask and then throwing it away,
yeah,
after one use,
yeah,
then that's a massive waste of resources, isn't it?
Well,
so I think a lot of people aren't even doing that, which means that actually a lot of the time they're wearing a mask which is actually contaminated.
But the masks don't, the masks do not work in stopping a virus.
Mm.
Like I said, if you're, especially these people that I've walked past lots of people today on the tube wearing cloth masks.
Yeah.
Now that cloth mask, if I was going to sneeze, okay, that cloth mask would stop it going 20 feet and just,
yeah,
go 10 feet. But who sneezes without putting their hands or a tissue in front of their mouth?
Right.
Who does that?
No, yeah.
So they do nothing. They do absolutely nothing. And the single-use ones just pollute the planet. They are really killing wildlife.
But if the person wearing it thinks it's doing them good, you have a problem with that?
I do, because I think it's part of the fear-mongering brainwashing that this whole nation has been put through. And we know this is true because of Laura Dodsworth's book, State of Fear. She kind of categorically breaks all the facts down there as the psychological operation that's been done on us. And the fear, I mean, I've got an aunt who's lovely and was the most dynamic aunt in the world, and now she will not come out of her house.
Mm.
If you've got the TV on all the time.
I mean, I know some older people who are concerned about that.
If you've got the TV on all the time. And I couldn't tell her that I'd gone on the the protest march, she'd be horrified.
Right.
And the thing is if she's watching BBC or any of the mainstream media, she's not going to hear about it. And that, for me,
that is extraordinary,
is so sinister. And Mike, it makes me really uncomfortable that this is the news channel that's supposed to report the news. Mm. And this is like being in China and Korea in some communist Stasi state where they only report what they want to report.
Yeah.
And then when they do report, like I think ITV said, a few hundred people. So that's an out and out lie. So our broadcast, mainstream media that we trust, that I innocently thought told us the truth, I don't believe them, because if they tell one lie there, a few hundred people, and I know it was just under a million, then so they've lied about that. Once you're a liar, you're a liar.
Yeah.
That's as far as I'm concerned. I don't believe anything that comes out
of their
mouth anymore.
I was very reluctant, I would say, even as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, to not defend any journalist that was attacked by someone. But now, some of the things that I've seen since Brexit, really, and the way that the BBC behaved during that, the way the mainstream television channels and radio channels have appeared to not represent those people they don't agree with, I've found it quite embarrassing, you know. And I now don't call myself really a journalist as such. I call myself part of the people, because that's how it feels. It feels as though it's them versus us. It feels as though they are trying to disguise what's really going on and convince people that something else is happening.
So when did that shift happen?
Well, I think it was Brexit.
Was it Brexit?
I think it was Brexit.
Because I think what it was is, and I know from family and friends that I've got up north who feel that, you know, that they've been let down by many things, whether rightly or wrongly. They firstly weren't allowed to have a conversation, whether it be Brexit or whether it be lockdown. You're not allowed to have a conversation. And that's the thing. There are people on television now who are absolutely for lockdown. And I am absolutely against it. But I can't go on and have a conversation with that person. And if they do have conversations, like Beverly Turner, who did the other day on This Morning, it's like a 3-to-1 attack.
Yeah.
And the facts that they're saying on air, so there's, you know, presenters on a mainstream channel giving erroneous facts to the public.
Right.
It's
this is
really
when she
worrying.
Was saying, well, it doesn't guarantee that you can't pass on COVID if you get the vaccine.
It doesn't.
And they were arguing with her. And she was like, well, she was right. There's no
she
question
was talking,
about that.
She was speaking the science.
Yeah.
And yet they were arguing with her. You're not. What's happened to having open debate about everything?
Right.
Since when did Britain become a country of censorship?
Yes. Well, Brexit is what happened. And it makes no accident, I think, that most of the people who will be the most vociferously against freedom are the people that wanted to stay in the European Union. And I don't want to say it like that, but I'm afraid that's kind of how it works itself out. Most of these Ramoners have now become lockdown fanatics. And that, and most people who wanted Brexit are much more likely to want freedom.
Well, I'm the anomaly then, because I wanted to remain.
Yeah.
But I didn't know enough about it, I'll be honest. I really didn't know enough about it, and I didn't vote. But in my thoughts, because I didn't know, but I felt unprepared, so I didn't vote. But I was happy to remain. But since seeing what's happened since Brexit, if there was another referendum, I would be voting to go out, because Europe seems to hate Britain.
Yes.
It hates us.
Well, certainly the European Parliament does.
The European Parliament,
Itself, it's a bit like Scotland and the arguments about Scotland, where people are saying, oh, you know, the Scots don't like us here, they don't want us going up to Scotland. That's absolutely not true. You know, there are people in Scotland who want independence, who are politicians and who are politically motivated, who make out that England is the source of all problems. That's not Scotland. And I speak as somebody whose family comes from Scotland, you know, and I know both countries very well.
Yeah.
And I have many friends in Scotland who, one, want to remain in the European, in the United Kingdom, and who don't want independence, and who love the English. And, you know, there's people married to English. You know, it's ridiculous to try and create this division.
But it's the media.
These people who are creating division.
But it's this whole divisive way of doing things. And we're not, you know, I'm all about joy. I mean, Matthew Wright, for example, who was on that television show, fighting for vaccines. I don't think that he loves his child less than I love my child or things like that. But I want to have a conversation about it.
I don't love his ponytail. I don't know what's going on with that.
Oh, no, I'm not sure about that.
Looks like he's got a wrap taped to the back of his head.
I'm not keen on that. But anyway, it's his choice. That's the point, isn't it, Mike?
Of course it is.
It's his choice.
Right.
He wants to have strange 80s weirdo hair. That's fine. It's his choice. And that's the thing that's missing now. We're missing open arguments, or not arguments, open discussions.
Yeah.
Just, and it doesn't have to be nasty. I don't call anyone any names. And I'm going to come off this show now.
Right.
And Twitter's going to be full of people calling me names.
And they'll be calling you irresponsible. At worst, they'll call you a murderer.
Oh, yeah. Where's my medical degree from Bill Gates? But Bill Gates doesn't have a medical degree, and yet he's advising the whole world what to do.
Neither do half the people at Sage.
Oh, I know.
Half of them are behavioural scientists.
Exactly. So he's got medical degrees.
There was one guy I was castigating at the weekend who was giving advice on what we should do about the lockdown. He's a mathematician. Now, I'm sure he's very good at maths, But what's that got to do with COVID? Exactly. Or me, yeah. Or my ability to go anywhere without wearing a mask? It's nothing to do with mathematics, I don't think.
I don't think it has anything to do with that. And again, it's all about people control. But you know, the why is the thing that Laura Dobbsworth yes. couldn't answer either. We don't know why this
she
is
was
happening.
At the march as well, wasn't she?
She was. She's a fantastic, brilliant woman. Mm. So we want to know the why. But while we're trying to find out the why, it's time to stop. We've got to be open for all.
Yeah.
We don't want vaccine passports. And we don't want to have to do tests to go into places. No one died of COVID. Mm. So we can just continue as usual, go back to the freedoms we had and start living that life and actually start addressing, for me, the conversation mm. should all be about collateral damage.
Of course.
The mental health of people. I mean, some of the things that happened over lockdown, people just don't want to talk about. Mm. 20% of non-accidental infant injuries, head injuries. Do you know what that means? Mm. That means 20% more babies were smacked around the head yeah. during lockdown. Do you get that?
Yeah.
And yet you don't want to talk about that. No, we don't talk about the collateral. I'm a COVID idiot. I'm a denier. This is what I get when I want to talk about children or the mental mm. health that everybody's going through.
So that's Tonya Buxton speaking on Mike Graham programme this week. First of all, Stanley, what do you make of her take on the idea that everything should just open up, that, you know, there's no reason to be keeping things closed down anymore?
Well, for the moment, normally everything should be opening up right now because the vaccines that are supposed to protect us have been distributed. And I agree with her that now everybody should open up and life should resume to the normal.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people getting worried and concerned about new variants, for example.
The new variants that are coming out right now, whether you are vaccinated or not, because when you get the vaccine, all of them are based on mRNA, either directly injected with a nanolipid coating or through an adenovirus vector. It's the mRNA for a specific protein on the adenovirus. So what it gives you is a monoclonal antibody to that virus. If that protein, that sole protein, mutates to the point where it doesn't cross-react with the monoclonal antibodies that you formed from the vaccine, then you are going to catch the COVID, the new strain of coronavirus. If, on the other hand, it cross-reacts, you will have a certain amount of protection. Up to now, it hasn't been shown, even though Pfizer from time to time comes out with a statement that their vaccine does protect against variants, certain specific variants. But up to now, they haven't done enough in vitro testing of antibody neutralizing tests to show that, you know, that it does.
Well, people okay, what about...
Caught,
what?
But they're very important. People who have caught the coronavirus, who were afflicted with SARS-CoV-2 and survived it, and we're talking about 99% of people who caught it survived it, have more than a monoclonal antibody against one specific protein. Your body developed proteins against many other structures of the coronavirus. So one who had the original coronavirus and had natural immunity to it is much more prepared for the variants than the people who were vaccinated and who are forming a monoclonal antibody against one specific protein of the virus.
But surely, I mean, that's an important protein, isn't it? Is it a specifically important protein which might be a more damaging one that those people are protected against?
Well, it's an important protein because it's in the attachment site. It's in the receptor site of the coronavirus. In other words, that's the protein that attaches to whatever cell is the target cell of the coronavirus, which is the first step in initiating infection. Then there are other steps, such as getting phagocytized into the cell, and then other steps for the RNA to be translated, other step for the translated protein to migrate to the membrane of the cells that have absorbed it. And then, of course, then it is presented to your immune system and you form that monoclonal antibody to it.
Now, Martin, can I bring you in here? Because Stanley thinks we should be opening up now. Do you agree?
Well, I think I'm not a medical person, so I think what also Stanley is stressing is that people have been vaccinated. And that, of course, is the mainstream view here in Britain. The government are planning to open everything up on June the 21st on the back of the vaccination programme. I don't think your first contributor is keen on vaccines at all. So I think we've got to distinguish between different views about different things. People have got various views about vaccines, various views about masks, various views about lockdowns. So there isn't just, you know, one camp over here and another camp over there.
Well, no, but I asked you, Martin, I asked you specifically about lockdowns, didn't I?
Well, what I would suggest is what the Prime Minister here, Boris Johnson, has said, although whether he's going to stick to it, I do not know. He said it's got to be data, not dates. And there is a fear of a third wave. I don't know whether that's justified or not. They're going to make a decision on June the 14th, I believe, about whether they're going to open up on the June the 21st. But one thing that's pretty obvious is he should have closed the airports. They closed the airport to people from India 3 weeks later than they intended so that he could do a trade deal with Narendra Modi. Now, of course, that hasn't actually transpired. And Bangladesh and Pakistan were both on the red list of countries you couldn't come to Britain from. But India was excluded, even though they had a far, this is where the danger is. Like a lot of people, I try not to be too dogmatic about these things. I'm listening to what everybody's saying, and it may be that they can open up on the 21st, or it may be, having made so many mistakes with this, because they're basically locked down too late and released too early three times, that's six unforced errors in a row, and we might as well finish now and get rid of this altogether if we can. But I don't, you know, I'm not dogmatic about it. We'll just have to see, won't we?
Well, you've certainly been, supportive of all the lockdowns so far, and
yes,
also saying that that they were all necessary. Stanley, what do you think?
Well, I wanted to point out something to Martin. The lockdowns have normally prevented a lot of respiratory viruses from circulating around. And second of all, when I say opening up, it's up to people whether they wear a mask or not, because a mask does protect you against aerosol-distributed viruses. Not 100%, probably around 50%. So if you open up and people can decide themselves whether to wear a mask or not, and one thing that's very important in this corona epidemic is that you have a morbidity rate, that is sickness rate, of around 40 to 50%, and 50% asymptomatic, and a mortality rate among the whole population of less than 1%. This is something very important to keep in mind. So as this lady Tanya was talking about, there are collateral damages to be looked at. Just like when a vaccine is being promoted, they say, well, the benefits outweigh the risks. Same thing, let's look at the lockdowns. Do the risks of the lockdowns justify the benefits of the lockdowns? The economic, social, the joblessness that it has caused, the worldwide economic chaos that it has caused. Has the lockdown you know, justify those collateral damages.
Yeah, well, look, let me ask you about the vaccines, though, because surely we don't really know what the effects of these vaccines is. They're all still really in the trial stage.
Yes, the third stage trials for the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines will be by the end of 2022, and of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine by 2023. This would be the normal route. This is the route that every other vaccine has taken. The fast track idea has come with the coming of the SARS-CoV-2. We didn't do that when we were looking for a vaccine for polio, a disease that if you caught it makes a corona infection look like a walk in the park. Yet it was tested for 7 years before it was administered to deliver our children from the scourge of polio. And it does work. Let me be clear about that. I'm an immunologist. I believe vaccines, since January up to now, has saved millions of lives. The problem now is the profit and greed of big pharma, which are sometimes introducing unnecessary vaccines and vaccines that could have, whose benefits definitely do not outweigh their risks.
Okay, well, can you prove that?
Can I prove it? Well, for one thing, for example, we're talking about the flu vaccine, which is becoming the norm for every year. We can see that there is no correlation between what one would expect, and this is what I was talking to you about, the statistics from 2010 to 2020, what we would expect as benefits is as the percentage of people who are vaccinated in a population increases year by year, we should see a corresponding decrease year by year in flu morbidity and mortality. We haven't seen that. As a matter of fact, like I've told you before, what we see is a zigzag line, which is readily available on cdc.org, where there is no correlation of the benefits of the vaccine. And yet it has become the norm for everybody to take it. It's a question of individual choice. People may choose to take it. I choose not to take the flu vaccine. Martin may choose to take it every year, and he feels that it works fine for him. But in general, when you're looking at the general population, at the statistical outlook for 10 years, the flu vaccine, the conclusion is that the flu vaccine doesn't really protect you.
It sounds to me as if we're relying much more on emotion than we are actually on the medical science. And how is that happening?
Well, this is what you call the white coat syndrome. When people are being told that something protects you, when it is being repeated ad nauseum by a media that is partly owned by big pharma, or whose lobbyists can influence whatever you see on TV or whatever politicians do in Congress, obviously there's going to be this common reaction to say, well, if everybody's taking it, if they're saying it so much, then, you know, it must really help. So it helps to go vaccinate. In my extended family, I would say about a third of them has been vaccinated and about two-thirds not every year. And it's a question of individual choice. But if I'm relying on the science, on looking at the statistical data for the last 10 years, you know, I don't feel like I have to take the flu vaccine every year.
Anyway, the big news this week is, I think, anyway, my opinion, is these BuzzFeed emails that have been released from Dr. Fauci. Before we hear the first of them, well, it's actually some clips of the Tucker Carlson program discussing them, and with also some clips of Fauci as well. What do you make of this guy? Because he seems to have been in his job for a long time. There is evidence we're bound to hear that he's just not being honest with the public. He's saying one thing to various colleagues on email and something completely different when he's in front of the press. So what do you make of this guy?
Well, a very simple thing. Notice how Fauci remained in his position and found a way to be a spokesperson in the White House under Trump and now under Biden. So I would have to say that he must be a very refined politician in order to navigate under 8 different administrations. But more, but I'll get to that later. Fauci has been in the public eye since 1983-84, since the search for the cause of HIV. A disease which I may point out that had a 100% mortality rate, not less than 1%, where we knew that all the blood supply of the world may be contaminated because hemophiliacs who were getting blood factors were getting AIDS. So it wasn't just restricted to homosexuals or heroin addicts. We knew we had to screen the world's blood supply against something, but we didn't know what that something was. And the person who first had a hint isolated the virus, the HIV virus, and sent samples around the world was Luc Montagnier at the Institut Louis Pasteur in France. When it got here, Fauci and a colleague called Gallo published as if they were the discoverer of the HIV virus, and this then created a scandal back then. I don't know how many people are aware of that, but Fauci has been with us since 1983 to 2021, and he has navigated his position through various diametrically opposed administrations. So I have to say, apart from being a scientist, he's also a very refined political navigator.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if he can keep his job with all the exposure that he's getting. And it's great to see. It's not just a little pipsqueak of a program like us. It's wonderful to see a massive network like Fox News dishing the dirt on Fauci, and well done also for BuzzFeed for digging out these emails. Much of them, many of them, were redacted. But let's hear the first clip now from the Tucker Carlson show about looking at Dr. Fauci now.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. The utter fraudulence of Tony Fauci is obvious now, and it's widely acknowledged. But it was not always obvious. In March of last year, we interviewed Fauci on this show. We treated him with respect. We took his answers seriously. We're Americans, so we assumed the man in charge of protecting the U.S. from COVID must be rational and impressive. We also assumed he must be honest. But we were wrong. It soon became clear that Tony Fauci was just another sleazy federal bureaucrat, deeply political and often dishonest. More shocking than that, we then learned that Fauci himself was implicated in the very pandemic he'd been charged with fighting. Fauci supported the grotesque and dangerous experiments that appeared to have made COVID possible. We came to these conclusions incrementally, spurred by evidence that accumulated over the course of a year. Tonight, we have the mother lode. Thanks to a Freedom of Information request from BuzzFeed, we have thousands of emails to and from Anthony Fauci. They go back to the early winter of 2020. Collectively, they show that from the beginning, Tony Fauci was worried that the public might conclude COVID had originated at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, why would Tony Fauci be concerned that Americans would conclude that? possibly because Tony Fauci knew perfectly well that he had funded gain-of-function experiments at that very same laboratory. The emails prove that Fauci lied about this under oath. Consider this exchange, which began the evening of January 31st, 2020. It was a Friday just before midnight. The first email came from an immunologist called Christian Anderson, who works at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Anderson warned Fauci that COVID appeared to have been possibly manipulated in a laboratory. Quote, the unusual features of the virus make up a really small part of the genome, less than 0.1%. So one has to look really closely at all the sequences to see that some of the features potentially look engineered. The next day, on February 1st, Tony Fauci wrote back, thanks, Christian. Talk soon on the call. Fauci then sent an urgent email to his deputy, a man called Hugh Auchincloss. The subject of that email, in all caps, was important. Quote, Hugh, it is essential that we speak this AM. Keep your cell phone on. Read this paper as well as the email that I will forward. You will have tasks today that must be done. Attached to that email was a document. It was entitled, quote, Barrick, Shi et al., Nature Medicine, SARS gainoffunction.pdf. Now, the Barrick in the attachment referred to Ralph Barrick, a virologist based in the U.S. who collaborated with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Barrick worked with a woman called Dr. Shi Shengli, known as the Bat Lady because she manipulates coronaviruses that infect bats. She was the Shi in the attachment. Now, keep in mind that during the questioning from Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky fairly recently, Tony Fauci denied that this same Ralph Barrick had conducted gain-of-function research. Again, this is the Ralph Barrick in Fauci's attachment, which was entitled Barrick, Shi et al., SARS gainoffunction.pdf. And yet, under oath before the United States Congress, Fauci denied this.
Dr. Barrett does not doing gain-of-function research, and if it is, it's according to the guidelines, and it is being conducted in North Carolina. And if you look at the grant, and you look at the progress reports, it is not gain-of-function, despite the fact that people tweet that.
Oh, it wasn't just on Twitter. It was in Fauci's own emails. In retrospect, that looks a lot like perjury.
Yeah, so that's the first of our clips from Tucker Carlson there. So Stanley, what he's really saying is that this guy is saying one thing to the public and saying something else to the other professionals. Is this sort of thing allowed to just carry on?
Well, first of all, this is all correct. But the bigger scandal, the bigger truth that should come out is that throughout the pandemic, since February, when papers appeared showing that certain drugs that didn't cost much, that did not have a patent on them, had strong antiviral action, were kept away from the public, whereas a very expensive drug like remdesivir, which at best was mediocre against the SARS-CoV-2 virus, was promoted by Fauci. This made Gilead Pharmaceutical close to $16 billion. And then after came the promotion of the vaccines in advance by Dr. Fauci, which made Moderna a fortune. And as we know, as I published on Facebook and ResearchGate, the CEOs, the high executives of Moderna, months before their vaccine went on the market, sold their shares and cashed in, whether the trial phase two had worked or not. So this is another scandal that needs to be investigated. Now, coming back to the gain-of-function experiments that are made, there are two ways you can do that. You can do that by serial passage in tissue cultures and let the virus naturally mutate as it goes from tissue culture to tissue culture, and you separate the different mutations. Or you can genetically insert information into the genomes of the virus by genetic engineering. And this is what was noticed at the beginning, that at certain cleavage sites, certain codons were that seemed to be of human origin were inserted into the genome of that bat virus to artificially modify it instead of letting it naturally modify through passage, multiple tissue culture passages. So that is what now is being put in evidence. And it seems that Fauci was very reticent about admitting his role in funding these researches in the Chinese lab. Now, let me tell you something. That doesn't mean that they were doing something criminal or that they intentionally released it. Far from that. I'm sure if there was a release, it was accidental. But they simply played a game with this corona vaccine, with this coronavirus, pardon me, that had it not been released, would not have been noticed. Probably somebody at the lab got infected with it, went home with a simple cold, because it's not that lethal of a virus, and then transmitted it to family members. From there, it grew algorithmic, you know, throughout the population in Wuhan, and then in the outlying areas and overseas through airplane travel.
Well, look, let me stop you there, Stanley. Martin, I know you think there are some motives that it may have been spread deliberately from Wuhan. So can we hear from you now?
Well, we've got to think about what the logical possibilities are here. It could have evolved naturally. That's still possible. It could have been a gain-of-function experiment in the Wuhan laboratory. Now, the Wuhan laboratory, if it's carrying out joint experiments with US funding, one presumes that it's not necessarily biological warfare that they're looking into. They're looking at gain-of-function research, as I understand it, in order to develop vaccines against potential threats. Now, I think there's a big question mark on whether that's a very sensible idea at all. But, of course, the real problem is the politics of this are getting very, very sharp, because the Chinese authorities are saying, we don't think it came from our laboratory. We're pointing the finger at the military games that took place in November when various US military personnel came to Wuhan and several of them were hospitalized with flu-like symptoms.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get at, Martin, is what might the motives be for
I'm just going to that. Yeah. Don't forget that the US is involved in a very, very strong confrontation with the Chinese at the moment. Their economy is about to overtake the US economy, not just in size, but also in scope. So they're developing technologies which are ahead of what the US has got. So the deep state in the US has got a very strong motivation to knock down the Chinese economy. Now, what the Chinese have pointed out, they've started sotto voce, but they're now getting louder, is a number of things. A, they point to the military games. B, they point to the fact that the Times of Israel reports that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defense Forces that a pandemic was coming out of China in November 2019, which implies they had foreknowledge of what was going to happen. The other thing, of course, we're talking earlier about the economic effects of the COVID crisis, but the banking system in the US collapsed in September 2019, and massive intervention was carried out behind the scenes to prop up the banking system. Now, what you could have here, and I'm pretty certain this is the kind of thinking that the Chinese intelligence services will be doing, they thought that SARS-CoV-1 was a potential biological warfare attack on them. And don't forget, during the Korean War, North Korea was absolutely saturated in botulism and all sorts. And of course, the Cubans are very well aware that there's been all sorts of attempts to, put biological agents into Cuba to wreck things like cotton production and so on. The real problem for many Western audiences is they can't get their head round why would they do that? They wouldn't do that. They're nice people, but they mean the West. They mean well. But if you know enough about NATO intelligence services and the way it's operated over the last 30 or 40 years, they're quite capable of doing something like that. And what the Chinese have done by having an administrative response very quickly to what happened, they've managed to basically clear COVID out of China. They've got some bits and bobs coming back in, but they're picking up on them immediately. And the Chinese economy, in fact, is running at full belt. Now, unless this is really, really resolved in the West, they are going to overtake. We're basically talking about geopolitical changes, which have been in the pipeline for quite a while, but they are now coming to a head. I think that what they were intending to do was to knock down the Chinese economy, and they were quite happy for it to flow back over the Western economies, because as has been pointed out, the pharmaceutical industries have got a very strong interest in a pandemic. And of course, this all leads back to possibly Fort Detrick in Maryland, which was the source of the anthrax, which killed six people after 9/11.
Okay, Martin, that's where it came from. What about Stanley was saying about these other treatments which were blocked by
Fauci? Well, I think that's a very legitimate point. What you would expect to happen is that the big pharma complex in the West would say you've got to have these experimental vaccines to deal with this, what is possibly a biological warfare agent. Whereas, in fact, it might be that ivermectin and other generic drugs are just as effective or more effective. That's what you'd expect to happen. Mm. But at the root of all of this, and this Fauci testimony is now bringing this to a head. I mean, even the Biden administration now saying we're going to have to look into the fact that this might be a created virus. And of course, it's been created. Don't forget that the money that was sent to the Wuhan virology lab came from DARPA, which is a part of the Pentagon. So the Pentagon were actually working with the virology lab in Wuhan. Now, that makes it absolutely easy for the Pentagon, if they wanted to release a virus in China.
Okay, well, Stanley, it would be nice to sit here
in order to wreck their economy.
Can we just hear, before we go on to the next clip, which involves the British this time and Fauci, what you make of Martin's conjecture there that actually there's quite a big economic war going on between China and the US, so it may be some deliberate leak in order to try and make the Chinese look bad or whatever?
I think everything Martin has said is quite correct. His analysis, even if it's not a scientific analysis of the virus, is the correct analysis. He's on point. And Fort Detrick in Maryland is where some of the most diabolical bacteriological and viral biological warfare agents have been elaborated. We are very lucky that more has not come out of it, has not escaped from this lab in Maryland. And he is absolutely correct. It is quite possible that, an American soldier during exercises brought the virus to Wuhan, just like it could have come out from the lab. What I'm trying to say that even if it came out of the Wuhan lab, it was totally accidental, because this is not a virus you would use in biological warfare, perhaps in economic warfare, but not in biological warfare. You don't use an agent that has less than 1% mortality as a biological agent. Anthrax, if you inhale it or ingest it, the anthrax spore, whether it's pulmonary anthrax or intestinal anthrax, you're dead. By the time you know you have it, nothing will save you. It's 100% mortality. So this is not the type of virus you would use for biological warfare. But the fact that it could have been brought to Wuhan, that Martin pointed out, is very possible, which reminds me of the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu that everybody gave the name the Spanish flu, like they're giving this the Chinese flu, originated with one of the soldiers from Kansas who brought it to Europe with the Lafayette Division. So that's very possible. Everything that Martin pointed out is plausible and logical.
Yeah, what about just on the Spanish flu? I mentioned that at the top of the hour, Stanley. There is a lot of talk that this was some experimentation going on over in the United States, particularly by John D. Rockefeller, a previous two generations from the more recent Rockefellers. In fact, there's an article up on Fort Russ saying, did Rockefeller create the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. Do you think there's any possible truth to that?
No, I don't think there's any possible truth for that, for the simple reason that we knew close to nothing about viruses in 1919. Around that time is when all the research on yellow fever by Walter Reed was being made during the Spanish-American War up to the beginning of the First World War. This is when we first knew that, and it was proven through inhumane experiments by Walter Reed, by the way, that yellow fever was transmitted by mosquitoes, by a mosquito vector. But he was at a loss to find the cocci or the bacillus that was causing the disease, because we didn't know about viruses then. That's when, by 1919, all we knew about viruses, and that's why they were given the name virus filtrant. In other words, they could go through filters that would stop bacilli and cocci, bacteria. But them, they still went through. But we didn't know enough about viruses back in 1919 to engineer a viral biological agent. So I think that's extremely doubtful.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's good. I love the way you're so honest about this, Stanley, the way that, we have to, I think, as medical practitioners and as journalists, keep an open mind, so we can say something is very likely. We don't have to walk away from something with a 100% conclusion. Most things are up there as a question mark in the balance. It may be that they're very obvious. It might be that there's a doubt. And I can remember many years ago, my physics teacher, Martin Black, he said to me, well, any scientist that tells you that they know what's going on is lying to you. All scientists can ever do is come out with theories. So this is why, when we're getting these so-called facts on the TV news adverts, as I call them, because a lot of the time the TV is not, comparing various different doctors' views. It's just simply putting out a specific government or pharmaceutical industry view that I don't think they're treating us fairly at all. Anyway, we're just talking about viruses generally. I mean, the vaccine is supposed to be the way of dealing with the virus. We had a vaccine called cowpox for smallpox, which is a naturally occurring thing. And actually, many people I've spoken to are saying, well, there's actually a perfectly natural vaccine for corona, SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, and that is the common cold coronavirus. So we could be giving everybody the common cold, this coronavirus common cold, and it would give people a good measure of protection against the COVID-19.
Well, before we do that, we have to show that the immune response to the common coronaviruses, and I have to tell you, in my time in the 70s, we knew of five different serotypes of coronaviruses that were common in the United States. As a matter of fact, serological surveys for antibodies showed that about 25% of children between the ages of 5 and 14 had positive antibodies to these coronaviruses. Now what we have to show, in order to use them as a vaccine, we would have to show that the immune response that they elicit cross-reacts with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Then yes, we could use them as a preventive measure by getting a much attenuated virus as a vaccine. As a matter of fact, we could make it a live vaccine that you inhale in an aerosol if it proves to elicit an immune response that cross-reacts with the SARS-CoV-2.
Well, I mean, you're saying if, but surely this is the most obvious thing to do. And why are we still saying if?
I don't know. It would be very easy. You know, showing cross-reacting antibodies is one of the simplest thing to do. And this is something I did routinely during my doctoral dissertation research. When I isolated this new virus, first I had to prove that it was a virus, and then I had to show what kind of cross-reaction with other retroviruses, or that subfamily of retroviruses called syncytium-forming viruses. And these are very, very easily done in agar plates.
You want to watch it, Stanley, because I'm going to give you homework for next week. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the second clip from Tucker Carlson. Here he starts to get into some of the discussions that were happening across the Atlantic with a person who is a particular bugbear of mine called Jeremy Farrar, who's the guy who completely refuses to talk to doctors in this country about treating COVID-19. So let's have a listen to that second clip from the Tucker Carlson show now.
We do know that starting early last year, a lot of people at NIH were worried that COVID had not occurred naturally. They were concerned it had been instead manipulated in a lab in China. And yet they seemed determined to hide those facts from the public. Again, why? On the afternoon of February 1st last year, Fauci held a conference call with several top virologists. Most of the details of that call were made hidden from public view. They've been redacted. We know the call was related to a document entitled Coronavirus Sequence Comparison. Jeremy Farrar, a British physician who runs a major research nonprofit, reminded everyone on the call that what they said was top secret. Quote, information and discussion is shared in total confidence and not to be shared until agreement on next steps, end quote. In other emails, Jeremy Farrar passed along an article from the website Zero Hedge. That piece suggested the coronavirus might have been created as a bioweapon. We now know that is a more plausible explanation than the one we believed at first and were told by the media, which is that corona came from a pangolin. And yet for the crime of saying that out loud, a more plausible explanation, Zero Hedge was banned from social media platforms. Until recently, you were not allowed to suggest that COVID might be man-made. Why couldn't you suggest that? The fact checkers wouldn't allow it. Why wouldn't they? Because Tony Fauci assured the tech monopolies that the coronavirus could not have been man-made. And so the tech monopolies shut down the topic. Watch Fauci lie.
A group of highly qualified evolutionary virologists looked at the sequences there and the sequences in bats as they evolve. And the mutations that it took to get to the point where it is now is totally consistent with a jump of a species from an animal to a human.
That was April 17th, 2020, very shortly into the course of this pandemic. At that point, what Tony Fauci just asserted as known could not conclusively have been known. That was a lie. Tony Fauci suggested that he knew because top researchers had decided conclusively that this must have jumped naturally from an animal to a human being. But again, at that point, he could not have known that. That was dishonest. 2 days after he said that, one of the virologists that Tony Fauci had funded to conduct dangerous coronavirus experiments in Wuhan wrote to thank him for the help. That man, a man called Peter Daszak, complained to Fauci that the American tax dollars he'd taken for these experiments were being, quote, publicly targeted by Fox News reporters. Yet Daszak remained grateful for Tony Fauci's support. Quote, I just wanted to say a personal thank you on behalf of our staff and collaborators, end quote. Now, strangely, most of this specific email from Daszak to Fauci has been redacted, and it was redacted under FOIA Section B7A. That specific exemption to the FOIA law applies to, quote, records or information compiled for law enforcement purposes, but only to the extent that production of those documents could reasonably be expected to interfere with enforcement proceedings. Are Peter Daszak and Tony Fauci under criminal investigation? We can only hope they are. They certainly deserve it. At this point, we can't say for sure.
Yes, yeah, so that is, again, Tucker Carlson and discussions on the lies. Now, this just seems as if, I mean, this guy surely cannot stand in his position when he's being accused constantly of being a liar. And on US TV with a tremendous amount of evidence too, Stanley.
Well, he survived the the AIDS virus scandal back in 1984. And like I said, like I've told everybody, and like I've been saying way before Carlson, since February of 2020, Fauci is a Dr. Anthony Fauci is a very refined politician. He knows how to survive from one administration to
but,
the
well,
other.
Why do you, I mean, he's not elected. He's a government official, isn't he?
Yes. More reason why he's such a refined politician.
Well, the politicians don't seem to want to sack him. Also, Martin, I mean, what he's referring to there is conversations with Jeremy Farrar, who's the boss of the Wellcome Foundation, a massive research foundation, which is one of these tax exempt things like the Gates Foundation. And Farrar and Fauci are discussing keeping this all what he calls top secret. The fact that this Zero Hedge research, which we actually also broadcast the first show we did in February 2020 before we were kicked off the airwaves, and that Zero Hedge research makes it absolutely clear that these two institutes in New Delhi were saying that there were apparently inserts which were unlikely to be natural ones on the genome after the Chinese had published it.
Well, I think the idea that it's not a natural virus has definitely got much more traction.
Yeah,
in
but
the last
point
week.
Is, why is this top secret? What is, you know,
well,
this
why
is
it's top secret?
Health issue.
Just basic things. If Fauci is in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, and this is a mechanism for basically enriching shareholders of Pfizer, for example, then they don't want that to come out, do they? But I suspect there's a bigger geopolitical agenda here. A biological warfare agent is not necessarily designed to kill loads and loads of people. What it's designed to do is wreck your economy unless you deal with it effectively in the very early stages, as the Chinese have done, of course. And they've basically been preparing for an attack of this sort by the United States for over 30 years. And they basically press the panic button, right, this is what this is. We're going to deal with it in the way that we prepared to deal with it. And they dealt with it very effectively to the extent that they've basically got rid of COVID without vaccines. They are now vaccinating in China because they realise that they're going to have to do that, and they're encouraging people to be vaccinated with their own Sinopharm vaccine, which, of course, isn't part of the big pharma complex in the West.
Well,
the Cubans have developed two separate vaccines,
and
the Russians have developed another vaccine, none of which has anything to do with the Western big pharma.
Yeah, and I'm trying to focus on this idea that these pharmaceutical industry giants who have managed to inveigle their way into the public sphere are keeping all of this stuff top secret, Stanley. I mean, surely this is, you know, that's the sort of thing you can excuse for, say, some sort of military operation, but not a public health crisis.
Well, Martin is, again, on point. The profit motive. Here is a virus that either was disseminated purposefully or accidentally escaped from the lab. It does have, there's almost no doubt that it has been genetically manipulated, whether it's at the Wuhan lab or at Fort Detrick and taken to Wuhan. But it's still a big profit-making mechanism for big pharma, for all the pharmaceutical companies, and for a lot of other people. Even Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. So the profit motive has totally overridden the health of the public. This is the catastrophe that we've been living since the 80s. If I may say so, the two people responsible for that are Reagan here and Margaret Thatcher in England, who gave to the world the Friedman neoliberal model. But that's another story. The reason that it has been a great benefit, you know, to somebody, to a company like Pfizer that declared almost $1 billion profit in the last trimester. So there's no better motive. There's to keep things secret or to have it done in the first place than the profit motive.
This well, you know what? The world. It reminds me a little bit of the whole Iraq war business, where, you know, they were keeping the Iraq war dossier and all the criticism of that top secret, even though it was completely made up. There was no 45 minutes weapons of mass destruction or anything like that. It was, the whole thing was a lie. So obviously, if you're lying through your teeth, you have to keep those lies out to the public, but you have to keep the fact that it's a lie top secret. Okay, the final
Let me point out something to you. There is a lady called Naomi Klein who wrote a book 15 years ago called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Whether it's a virus pandemic, whether it's an earthquake, or whether it's a war, this is top money-making for the big multinational corporations. And somebody came out with a very beautiful meme, which is, when war is your business, peace becomes the enemy. When you're making billions, if not trillions, out of war, natural disasters, or diseases, good health and peace become your enemies.
Okay, well, we're going to hear the third clip now. At least we're going to try to. Dave will try to play it in. And that is from the third clip from the Tucker Carlson Show. And final one, you'll be pleased to hear. And this is looking at the emails about vaccines and also about masks and the mask policies.
We do know that Fauci hasn't simply lied about the origins of COVID, pretending to know things he could not know. He has also lied about vaccines in key ways. In March of last year, former Obama official Zeke Emanuel wrote to Fauci to ask a very simple question, one that we've asked countless times. Are people who have recovered from COVID generally immune from getting infected with COVID once again? That applies to about 100 million Americans, so it's not a small question. Fauci's response, quote, "No evidence in this regard, but you would assume that there would be substantial immunity post-infection." Well, yes, you would assume that. We always have. And in fact, studies now show it is true. People who have had COVID and recovered almost never get sick again from COVID, so they don't need to be vaccinated. Yet to this day, Tony Fauci has never admitted that in public. In his email to Zeke Emanuel, he admitted something else that's also now obvious. Surgical masks, the paper kind all of us wear, don't really work. They offer very little protection from COVID. In fact, at least one study shows they may accelerate transmission of viruses. They are, in short, a form of make-believe. Yet once again, while under oath in public, Tony Fauci claimed precisely the opposite.
You're telling everybody to wear a mask, whether they've had an infection or a vaccine. What I'm saying is they have immunity, and everybody agrees they have immunity. What studies do you have that people that have had the vaccine or have had the infection are spreading the infection? If we're not spreading the infection, isn't it just theater?
No, it's not.
You got the vaccine and you're wearing two masks. Isn't that theater?
No, that's not. Here we go again with the theater. Let me just state for the record that masks are not theater. Masks are protective. And we
have immunity there, theater. If you already have immunity, you're wearing a mask to give comfort to others. You're not wearing a mask because of any sign.
I totally disagree with you.
Rand Paul is a physician. He's smart. What he just said was true, and the science shows that it's true. There's not much debate about it, actually, among honest people. But Tony Fauci claimed it wasn't true. He lied. Why would he do that? Well, here's one reason. The emails show that Tony Fauci speaks regularly to Bill Gates. That's odd. Bill Gates is not a doctor. Bill Gates is not a scientist. Bill Gates is a very rich man who made billions making mediocre software for office computers. So why would Tony Fauci be in such regular contact with Bill Gates? The term Bill Gates comes up more than two dozen times when you search the Fauci emails. Has Bill Gates profited in any way from Tony Fauci's COVID guidance? That would definitely be worth knowing immediately. And yet we don't know. Our media don't seem interested in finding out. In fact, here's how CNN covered the emails today. Quote, thousands of emails from and to Dr. Fauci revealed the weight that came with his role as a rare source of frank honesty within the Trump administration's COVID-19 task force. Can you imagine a more dishonest characterization of anything than that? It's hard to. By the way, it wasn't just CNN. No reporters asked about these emails at today's White House press briefing. Not one question. But you shouldn't be surprised. Of course they didn't ask. Tony Fauci is too big to question at this point. Quote, oh my God, one Biden voter wrote to Tony Fauci back in March. Is there anything I can do for you besides being grateful? Wash my feet with your tears, Fauci may have responded. We can't say that he did respond that way for certain. We don't have his reply. We do know that in affluent neighborhoods throughout Northwest Washington, D.C., you can still see signs that say, thank you, Dr. Fauci. What does that tell you? It tells you that Tony Fauci is no longer a scientist, assuming he ever was one. Tony Fauci is a figure of religious veneration. He is Jesus for people who don't believe in God.
Jesus for people that don't believe in God. How about that, Martin?
Well, I basically can't be bothered to argue too much about masks. It's not something.
Well, it's not really the question. Have different views about it. The question is when we've got a public health official that's quite clearly working for the pharmaceutical companies
well,
and
I
not
think
for the public.
This is fundamental. The political economy of health in the United States, in particular, is shocking. In the 1960s, Ivan Illich wrote a book called Medical Nemesis, which was about how the essentially commercialization of health in the US was leading to loads and loads of problems with people's health, because it's essentially an illness system. The pharmaceutical companies with a profit motive do not want to find cures for diseases. What they want to do is find ongoing interventions that they can make money out of. And a Goldman Sachs guy at one of the pharmaceutical conferences said, you know, the business model of curing things is hopeless. But of course it is, for example, in Cuba, the goal of, they've got one of the best healthcare systems in the world, despite being a third world country and under sanctions. And they've developed their own vaccines completely independently. They've got two of them. And they're testing them at the moment, and they're ready to run them out, both in Cuba and, of course, in all the places around the world where they work, because they've got thousands of their personnel operating in some of the poorest countries in some of the most difficult conditions. The contrast couldn't be clearer. Communist China, with its basic primary healthcare system, they basically dealt with it. The same in Vietnam. The same in Taiwan, which has got a nationalist government.
Okay, let's hear Martin. Let's hear what
people have actually.
Let's hear what Stanley has to say about the way that. Let's hear what Stanley has to say about the way that China dealt with it, and your idea that you've got to have a strict lockdown. New Zealand, for example.
I think the way China reacted to it was the correct way, especially when they thought that they were under probably under economic attack from the United States, as Martin pointed out. As they say, the expression, they nipped it in the bud, which was a great way to deal with it. They totally isolated the city for a very short period of time compared to the length of time that we have done this, here in the West, on and off for over a year. And China is back online full strength.
Yeah, but is that the right thing to do with a virus which the mortality rate is something like 0.5%? To lock down the whole population?
Well, when you run the risk of being totally quarantined by the rest of the world, when your export may be, all of your exports may be quarantined, yeah, it is the right thing to do. Because it's not only biological warfare in the sense of sickness, it was biological warfare in the sense of psychological warfare and commercial warfare. And they could have taken any excuse to ban any export from China, saying that you might be contaminated. People here in the United States were afraid to buy toys that have been in the store for years because they were made in China.
Well, we even had people in Stroud saying that they wouldn't go to the Chinese restaurant in February 2020 because they thought they would catch the virus from the Chinese people there. Anyway, look, let's get on to look at this psychological warfare aspect of it. And there's a terrific bit of work being done by Patrick Fagan, who is a behavioral psychologist. And he quotes here, we're about to hear a bit of an interview with him, a book by Margaret Heffernan. It's called Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril. And here is Patrick talking about the idea, very simple idea, that through behavioral psychology, you can persuade the public to do just about anything.
There's a good book called Willful Blindness, and a psychologist I used to work with used to say the mind only lets you see what it thinks you can handle or something like that. But the idea being that some of the implications may be so terrifying and potentially psychologically traumatic that people just can't face up to them. It's the ostrich effect. They kind of put their head in the sand and they can't handle the cognitive dissonance. And similarly, there's systems justification theory where people who have benefited from the system, the UK, the government and state and so on, that they can't countenance that it would ever do anything wrong or do anything harmful. And then again, there's, just authority in general. You're just more likely to follow authority figures and believe what they're saying because they're in positions of authority. And this is a bias that's kept us alive and society functioning since time immemorial. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can... it's a bit like a moth flying into a candle. You know, moths following lights have kept them alive for a long time, but it just sometimes it can go a bit askew in the modern world. Then, of course, there's conformity. Some people are just scared to make alternative opinions known. And, of course, some people, perhaps rightly so, are very scared of the virus. And so that fear is kind of keeping them from doing anything unorthodox. But yeah, I think it is mostly fear of ostracization, fear of the virus, or fear of the potential implications, and challenging your entire worldview is a very traumatic, scary thing.
Yeah, so that's Patrick Fagan there talking about the book and various concepts in behavioral psychology, Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril by Margaret Heffernan. Stanley, do you recognise some of these tactics? Have you been a bit, concerned about the way that, these authority figures have kind of, it's a bit like kind of, Big Brother characters turning up on TV. What do you make of this behavioural psychology aspect? Because it does look as if there is definitely some attempt to use psychology in order to get the public simply to do what officials want them to do. And, of course, that isn't really appropriate in a medical setting. You have to, as a doctor, you have to, you know, your patient has to make informed consent. Here, what we're doing is we're using behavioral psychology in order to get them to do what we want them to do, not what they want to do, and they're not being informed, so they can't have informed consent.
Well, this is something that's been known in medicine for a long time. It was given a name. It's called the white coat syndrome, where the patient, once in front of the man with the white coat, becomes totally infantile, doesn't reason for himself, and believes whatever the man in the white coat tells him. It's called the white coat syndrome. This is a very, very common thing. And let me give you an example of how it was done on a national, even international scale. Last week, I was watching NBC News, which I fell on by accident. NBC Nightly News at 6. And here they were doing a revelation, speaking as if it was a great revelation. Do you know some scientists are now saying that even if the antibody titer that you had against the COVID-19 goes down, there are cells, mysterious cells in the bone marrow that remember the virus, and that gives you protection even if your antibody titer is no longer detectable. You still have these cells in your bone marrow that remember the virus. Well, because they were saying, well, you can catch it twice, or if you take the vaccine, you might need boosters every year. This comes like a big revelation, as if scientists just discovered that. My goodness. This is common knowledge. You don't even have, that's immunology 101 or even advanced high school biology, that once you are infected with a virus, you develop memory B cells and memory T cells that are primed for a secondary response long after your antibody titers have gone down, because you don't need them anymore. Those B cells stop making antibodies because you're no longer infected, it's been a while, but that are ready at a moment's notice, on a, you know, trigger notice, to produce antibodies and killer T cells against the virus. We've all known about memory cells in immunology, and yet they were announcing it last week, and I was almost enraged that they could take something that's been common knowledge since the beginning of immunology and announcing it as if it's a new scientific discovery, because all of the lies that were told during the pandemic are coming out, whether it's through the emails of Dr. Fauci, the new analysis of the virus. So now they are beginning to CYA, cover your ass. They're beginning to cover their asses. They're putting common knowledge out as if it's new scientific discovery. And somebody said that as the Fauci emails are being released, and Tucker Carlson spoke about the CNN reaction, this is very normal. Now they're going to say, well, 18 months later, does it matter? Or as the White House spokesperson said, oh, it's not helpful to talk about emails of 17 months ago. This is almost outrageous, yet the public swallows it.
Well, yeah, well, certainly some
do. Just like now, today, it has become irrelevant. It has become totally irrelevant that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The public has forgotten it,
yeah,
that they were taken to war by a lie. Well, same thing with this pandemic. They are taking basic truths that were there, that they hid, that they purposefully hid until all of Big Pharma can make all the money they could make, and now they're revealing them as if it's new discoveries. I was enraged when I saw this report on NBC News. because this is something a good high school biology student would have known since the 60s.
Amazing. Okay, I wonder if you've got any concluding remarks, Stanley. I think we should, you know, politely wave goodbye to you now. You've stuck with us through thick and thin this time. Can you see a day when the public gets back control of health policy?
Unless there is enlightenment, a sudden enlightenment of the public by politicians that become conscientious and are no longer in the pocket of lobbyists, it will not happen. But let me, as a conclusion, let me say something more important. We are being presented, there are variants of the virus that are coming out, you know, either through natural mutation or perhaps engineered so that new vaccines may be needed. But even through just natural selection, it's normal that when you have monoclonal antibodies for a virus, that it mutates to beat that monoclonal antibody and a new variant comes along. So it is much more logical to fight this coronavirus, if we're going to consider it that important, by putting research into antiviral medicine instead of vaccines. We already have ivermectin that, as I've sent to you, the data shows that within 48 hours, with the right doses and tissue cultures, it eliminates all corona, SARS-CoV-2 virus multiplication. So we know that in vitro it can be 100% effective, yet it was hidden for the public for the last year, and I don't know why. And for this could have cost lives. For this, there should be a criminal investigation. While they were promoting their remdesivir, which, by the way, is an adenine analog, and which doesn't work that well. So I hope that we realize, with many variants coming out that may be antigenically distinct from one another, it would be more helpful to develop antiviral that blocks the virus at various stages of replication, from penetration to RNA multiplication to RNA translation and to presenting the antigen. This would be a much more effective way of combating this corona SARS-CoV virus than vaccinating people every year for a new variant.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but one sort of supplemental question there is, we've got this guy, Dr. Vernon Coleman, here in the UK. He wrote a book called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. Do you think that there's an element of truth in that? Because many of the decisions about this have been made by people who are medically trained doctors in public positions.
Yeah, well, that is the problem with a lot of medically trained doctors who are not scientists. One of my duties when I was a graduate student, a doctoral candidate, was to teach second year infectious diseases to medical school students. And not all of them are necessarily that brilliant or that interested in infectious diseases to understand, you know, the basic mechanisms that are involved. They become doctors and then they follow whatever the American Medical Association recommends for certain diseases. So,
yes, yeah, so what you're saying is they're not really thinking for themselves.
Correct. They're following just like the syndrome, the sheep syndrome among the public. There's the same syndrome among doctors, especially when they're afraid to be sued. When they can say, like, I think I've told you that the only person I know that died from corona, that I knew personally that died, it was one who was hospitalized. Whereas 15 others who followed simple treatment of ivermectin and an antibiotic to prevent secondary infection, and if needed, steroid to prevent a cytokine storm, all survived very well, and they went from ages 65 to 71. Well, that person who was in the hospital, whenever we would try to call the hospital, this was back in July, all they'd answer is that, very sorry, we're following CDC guideline. And that's it, period. So they don't follow, you know, if they're sued, they can always say, well, I was following CDC guidelines.
Well, maybe someone should sue the CDC, eh? Anyway, yeah. Anyway, it's lovely. Thank you very much, Stanley. Where do people find your work online? I know you've written a book too, haven't you?
Yes, but my book is not necessarily it's about my undergraduate years and the Vietnam War and the invasion of Cambodia. My scientific work can be seen on ResearchGate or right now on Facebook, which I'm going to make public instead of just for friends.
Okay, Dr. Stanley Laham from Florida. I won't say exactly where, somewhere near Tampa, Lauderdale. Thank you very much for joining us. And we will carry on now, Martin and I.
A pleasure.
Listening to, I think it's quite an interesting clip anyway. It's about this whole idea, which has been leading up to the Great Reset, about climate change and Agenda 21. And I came across this clip this week from a woman called Anne Bressington, who's an Australian politician. She had quite a lot to say back in 2013 about the idea of a climate threat, a climate emergency being cooked up by people who realised that the Cold War was going to dissolve and they needed another threat to threaten humanity. The group is called the Club of Rome, and we'll hear what Martin Summers makes of this after this clip.
Ladies and gentlemen, the origins of the environmental movement as we see it began back in 1968 when the Club of Rome was formed. The Club of Rome has been described as a crisis think tank which specialises in crisis creation. The main purpose of this think tank was to formulate a crisis that would unite the world and condition us to the idea of global solutions to local problems. In a document called The First Global Revolution, authored by Alexander King and Bertrand Schneider, on pages 104 and 105, it stated, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers, of course, will be caused by human intervention that will require a global response." That's the origin of global warming, ladies and gentlemen. In 1975, Australia agreed to bring in a new economic order via the Lima Declaration on the second conference of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization. The outcome of this was, as I said, the Lima Declaration, which was a blueprint for the redeployment of tools, jobs, and manufacturing to the developing nations, leaving countries like Australia short of technology, a manufacturing base, and jobs. Blind Freddy can now see what the outcome of that has been for our country, with their unworkable trade and tariffs agreements hand in hand with this that have followed as a matter of course. This is now a reality, with around 90% of our agriculture and manufacturing just gone. Australia signed the Lima Declaration and hundreds of others with the support of all major political players. Whitlam, Fraser, Hawke, Keating, Hewson, Howard, Rudd, the Democrats, the Greens, and even the Nationals. It has been put to me that all of these treaties were the foundation for the rollout of Agenda 21. And it seems that Australia has been moved around the global chessboard, and our so-called leaders were either complicit or naive to the long-term consequences. And now we're almost at checkmate. In 1992, former President of the United States, George Bush Sr., said, "Effective execution of Agenda 21 will require a profound reorientation of human society, unlike anything the world has ever experienced. a major shift in the priorities of both governments and individuals, and an unprecedented redeployment of human and financial resources. This shift will demand that a concern for the environmental consequences of every human action will be integrated into individual and collective decision making at every level. Cutting through the code, I want everyone to consider what the words profound reorientation of all human society and unprecedented redeployment of human and financial resources actually means. For everyone here tonight not familiar with Agenda 21, I would suggest that this is the beginning of your learning curve, not the end. In 1992, Maurice Strong, Secretary General of the UN Earth Summit and member of the Club of Rome, said, "It is clear that current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class involving high meat intake, consumption of large amounts of frozen and convenience foods, use of fossil fuels, ownership of motor vehicles, small electrical appliances, home and workplace air conditioning, and suburban housing are not sustainable." Put those statements together with the previous one, and it must become clear that Agenda 21 is about controlling every aspect of our lives: how we eat, what we eat, how much we eat, how we move around, food production, the amount of food, and where we even live.
So, Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, I think the account of how the environmental movement emerged is a bit one-sided. You've got two environmental movements, effectively. There's what a top-down one, which is being run by people, you know, the Club of Rome essentially is an oligarch's club. And they basically, you know, the there's also a sort of bottom-up environmentalism. You know, E.F. Schumacher, I used to work for the New Economics Foundation. His book, Small is Beautiful, came out, I think, in 1970. And, you know, the question, you know, it's pretty obvious. I mean, as Gandhi pointed out in the 1940s, you know, there is not enough. There's plenty for everybody's need, but not for some people's greed. And it is pretty appalling that you've got, you know, a privileged overlord class in wealthy countries, which consume far more resources per head than, you know, than people in poorer countries.
Yeah, but the main point
of capitalism.
The main point she's making there is that the idea of you know, once the Soviet threat has gone on, we need a new threat.
Well, they're going to find new threats. Global warming, you know, the kind of greenwashed multinational companies going about global warming. You feel like saying, well, what about nuclear war? Surely that's more of an immediate threat. And of course, in the 80s, we were far more aware that we could just be incinerated in a nuclear war. And I would put the second threat after nuclear war as financial collapse. The real problem is not that the global war is that the banking system could just disappear overnight, which would leave everybody in absolute chaos. And of course, that would require massive redistribution of resources. Ultimately, of course, in the 60s, you know, in the developing world, the Vietnam War was being fought, and ultimately the Americans were kicked out of Vietnam. They bankrupted their own economy in the process, and Vietnam is now pursuing an independent development path, as is China, as are other developing countries which have, to some extent, thrown off the shackles of Western colonialism.
Yeah, but what about what she's saying there about this concept? In fact, you were echoing it in a way. Is saying that, you know, you've got this bottom-up and top-down environmentalism. You know, it seems to me it is rather like many movements that are allowed to flourish for a while, and then they get basically hijacked by foundation funded people, individual specific people who are funded to to direct them effectively.
That's right. Well, I mean, what happens is that civil society creates different movements and new ideas emerge, and of course elites have got their own take on all of that. And it's quite clear, you know, all multinational companies now all claim that they're up for sustainability and they want a sustainable future. Now, this is basically what they really want is to carry on making loads of money, but they want some kind of cover story. I mean, you know, the real problem is international capitalism. We need to abolish the international financial system as currently constituted and create a multipolar world order that allows countries to develop without being crushed. And of course, there are plenty of countries in the world at the bottom end of the scale who cannot get to base one because the system just doesn't allow it. And, this is ultimately going to lead to huge tensions, as it has done. And the real danger we face, the most immediate danger, as I say, is nuclear war. If what had happened in Ukraine earlier in the year had come to a head, we would have had a complete nuclear face-off between the Russians and the West. And, the potential for a mistake when both sides are gunning for each other is enormous. I mean, 1983,
incinerated. Is it, Martin? It's not really fair because ordinary people feel they can do something about climate change, but they can't do anything to stop a nuclear war.
Well, they could do something to stop a nuclear war, which is stop. The war propaganda to which we're being constantly subjected is overwhelming. And, the European Parliament, for example, has just passed overwhelmingly a resolution not to ratify the trade deal that's been done with China. Now, they've got their reasons for doing that, which is they're claiming about the poor people in Hong Kong, genocide in Xinjiang.
Oh, yeah, a matter of principle when it suits them.
Yes. But of course, ultimately, the Chinese will say, OK, no deal then. But we will carry on doing they're doing deals in their local region with local countries which are close to them. And, if the Europeans don't want any part of that, well, that's up to them. But they're not going to change the Chinese policy by doing that. That's to keep basically, the Europeans are just doing what the Americans have told them to do.
Okay.
New Zealand, has refused to call what's happening in Xinjiang genocide. They said they're not happy with it, but we're not going to call it genocide. And, of course, other countries in Southeast Asia know that their future lies in a cooperative relationship with China. And they're not going to, that's not going to change.
Yeah, OK. So we need to crack on, Martin. We're going to also have a listen now to on the Bilderberg place. What we got here is a non-meeting, isn't it? It looks like we're supposed to have forgotten that Bilderberg ever existed.
Well, we don't know. As you say, they could be meeting in secret, as they used to do. They may have decided to dissolve and reconstitute it as something completely different that we're not being told about.
Yeah, I had quite a long chat the other night on the Lou Collins show with a guy called Mark Anderson, who writes for the American Free Press in the US, about what's going on with the Bilderbergers. And he came out with, I thought was quite rather interesting stuff about some guy in the US who's actually being hauled before these various state committees for actually going to the Bilderberg conference. So, they've got that thing called the Logan Act in the United States where you're not allowed as a politician to go to these little private clubs. The Americans obviously had a lot of trouble with that in the past where small private outfits were basically running the show and controlling politicians and bribing politicians. So he was hauled over the coals for that. The guy's name is John Hickenlooper, and here is Mark Anderson from the American Free Press in Michigan, just talking about that with me on the Lou Collins show a couple of days ago.
A year ago, John Hickenlooper, who was catapulted into the Senate, the U.S. Senate, and beat Cory Gardner, a Republican. Hickenlooper is the longtime Colorado governor. He's a Democrat. Well, he couldn't make it as a presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket to try and get the primary nod. So Hickenlooper was retrofitted to become a Democratic U.S. senator, and sure enough, he got in. Well, about a year ago, Hickenlooper was the first person to attend Bilderberg to be censored by the state government where he calls his home, precisely for going to Bilderberg. The Ethics Committee of Colorado investigated Hickenlooper, the longtime Colorado governor, former mayor of Denver. They investigated him for going to the 2018 Bilderberg meeting in Italy, and it was quite a probe. And when I wrote the Bilderberg people about it, their media people, they responded, which isn't real common. They don't often respond. Sometimes they do. And they responded very tersely. We don't discuss member status or members, status or coverage in the media or, whenever any of their members are profiled in the media, especially negatively. They're saying they don't comment, but you could tell they were a little miffed by it. I don't know if it had any direct input in slowing Bilderberg down, maybe taking a little wind out of their sails. They don't like that kind of publicity. There was a lot of damage control going on. Hickenlooper was questioned for like 15 hours about Bilderberg. There were some other meetings that the international the state ethics committee, rather it wasn't international, it's a state ethics committee, created under a ballot measure that the voters of Colorado approved. When they approved that referendum or ballot measure, it created this ethics committee. And of the 15 or so hours they spent on Hickenlooper, the majority of that was grilling him on Bilderberg. And he was actually found to be in contempt of the ethics committee for his answers on Bilderberg. They weren't satisfied with his answers. They found it to be a grave conflict of interest that he even went there, let alone what happened. So it wasn't a huge black eye for Bilderberg, but it was an unprecedented and unusual thing, at least in recent decades. And I just wonder, in the back of my mind, in the rearview mirror, whether that might have taken some of the wind out of the sails of Bilderberg. That was coming out of, by the time that he was investigated, that was late 2019 into 2020. They had already had their Swiss meeting in Montreux. Like I say, this was from the year before 2018. So ever since that probe of Hickenlooper was completed, Bilderberg did not meet again. Again, whether there's a causality there, I don't know. But it's worth mentioning that they ran into some unusual negative publicity, although it did not go national like on ABC News or something. But as Tony knows, they don't like negative press. They don't like any press unless it's Zanny Minton Beddoes of The Economist, who actually goes to Bilderberg but doesn't talk about it, and so on and so forth. She actually appeared, incidentally, and I'll have to depart with this. She appeared at a Chicago Council on Global Affairs meeting that I happened to get into. It's sort of the Chicago CFR. In fact, they used to be called the Chicago CFR, and they changed their name to the CCGA. And Zanny Minton Beddoes was there, and I asked her sort of an oblique question, it sort of nibbled on the heels of Bilderberg. It wasn't directly about Bilderberg, but it's clear that they like to avoid any implication or publicity, direct or indirect or implied. And so it was a way to put a little pressure on one of their big members. And it's not easy, to get face-to-face with them. So I took advantage of it. But I reported heavily and called the Ethics Committee about Hickenlooper's Bilderberg probe. And so it's sort of a backstory now, almost a forgotten item. But it did appear to take the wind out of Bilderberg's sails a little bit. But certainly they don't give up easily, as Tony talked about there. And they're probably having a delay in what's going on. It's possible they'll fold or take a long break because they've achieved a lot of their objectives. Or like Tony said, they've got a lot of their people where they want them.
Yeah, so that's Mark Anderson there from American Free Press, Martin. It's interesting, isn't it? He's talking there about, that Bilderberg don't like negative publicity. Actually, no, he was also saying that they don't like any publicity, so they don't even want to get positive publicity. There's not many organizations you can say that for.
No, and it may well be because of all of the kind of sleuthing that people like you have been doing over the years, that the actual Bilderberg meetings have become less useful to them. And of course, it wouldn't have just been the Bilderberg meeting that decided everything anyway. I mean, they've got all sorts of mechanisms for elite groups, have all sorts of mechanisms for meeting each other and making decisions.
The specific role of the Bilderberg was very important in that it was an open meeting, in that it wasn't given publicity. They didn't ask for publicity, but there was no kind of secrecy. And this is a very good way, I think, to schmooze potential politicians into their circles over lunch, over coffee or whatever, because it doesn't come across as a clandestine secretive group at all, that they're having to keep everything undercover. And that's actually the sort of thing that a potential recruit from the world of politics is much more likely to trust, Martin.
Well, that's right. And of course, the real issue here is the people from the world of politics, because in effect, you know, if wealthy oligarchs want to get together and have a meeting, there's nothing to stop them. But I would argue that what happened in, as was described by the contributor there, that elected politicians go to this kind of meeting, they need to report on what they said and what was agreed. I mean, you know, they are supposedly the representatives of the people, and they're not supposed to just go to meetings in the people's time, effectively, or even if they're going in their own time, I'd still want to know what they're doing. And I think that's the weak link of Bilderberg. I mean, Bilderberg, effectively, as I've said before, is a bit like a horse fair, where the real power movers and shakers get to look at the potential politicians and decide whether they're going to back them or not.
Well, that's right. It's like the military lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby.
That's right.
You know, there are
the politicians
lobby,
are clearly the junior partners.
Yeah, to say nothing of the financial lobby, the Goldman Sachs, who now seem to, I mean, in fact, over the last 20 years, seem to have gotten their way into just about every treasury in Europe. I mean,
not just in Europe, around the whole world.
Well, yes, Rishi Sunak is a bigger beast. Rishi Sunak is a former Goldman Sachs guy. So, you know, you won't necessarily see him at Bilderberg, unless, of course, it's a secret one that's just taken place. But he's already in their pocket, effectively. Anyway, the other thing I'd like to say about the Bilderbergers is going back to the Freemasons, because the guy that organised the Bilderberg conference in Turnberry in 1998, by some coincidence, and they teased this out of me, Lou Collins and Mark Anderson, was a guy called Andrew Palmer. Andrew Palmer just so happens to be, or happened at the time, to be the private secretary to the Duke of Kent. Now, the Duke of Kent is the Queen's cousin, Prince Michael, and he is also, at the same time, the Grand Master of United Grand Lodge of England, so the top Freemason in Britain, and some would say the world. So interesting that it's his private secretary that organises the Bilderberg conference. Not a lot of people recognise this influence of Freemasonry. What do you make of the Masons, Martin?
Well, historically, the Masons were, a secret society dedicated to revolutionary ideals, related to things like the French Revolution. And so, you know, people like Mozart, the magic flute, there's all sorts of Masonic messages in that. And they've continued to be, the rising bourgeoisie, if you like, which was the backbone of Freemasonry, of now, you know, for many years, they've been the ruling class. And of course, people like Franco, for example, were very hostile to Freemasonry because his Catholic nationalism saw Freemasonry as a liberal threat. But of course, today, Freemasonry has evolved into...
Let's not forget Adolf Hitler.
Well, indeed, yes. I mean,
what I've heard is that Hitler was, I mean, obviously they had their own secret societies, the Nazis did, the Tool Society, they had their Wewelsburg Castle where the SS had their meetings. They realised that the Freemasons, that they didn't want any other competing secret societies around at the time.
Oh, that's right.
So that's how they got rid of them.
Well, traditionally, Freemasonry was associated with French revolutionary politics. So like the Carbonari in Italy, which were the secret society dedicated to unifying Italy, they were modelled on the Freemasons. And of course, before Marxism came along, a lot of left-wing politics was conspiratorial. You didn't have an open structure. You recruited people privately, and that was the model. And the Freemasonry fitted that exactly. But of course, modern Freemasonry is embedded within, you know, big business structures. And of course, even at local level, the main allegation against them is that they basically stitch up contracts in private for the benefit and enrichment
of the insiders. Another biggie is the planning system. If you want planning permission,
yeah,
go and grease a few Masonic palms and you'll find the piece of paper, you know, arrives first class tomorrow saying you've got your planning permission.
Well, Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations said that businessmen never get together even on social occasions, without some conspiracy against the public being concocted. And that was, you know, his view. And
anyway, Martin,
Freemasonry didn't exist. The vested interests of, you know, the business classes would be worked out through something else. In China, for example, a lot of the business classes and the entrepreneurs are part of the Communist Party. Part of the Communist Party because that's part of how they get their businesses.
Yeah, well, also part of the triads as well. And Yakuza in Japan.
There's quite a number of these kind of organisations because this kind of idea of having an in-group and an out-group and a planning, you know, it's a fairly basic way in which things are organised, isn't it? Whether you're a Freemason or a Communist or whatever it is.
Well, it depends if you're taking a blood-curdling oath that everyone in the group can kill you if you speak a word out of turn. That's what really makes a difference. Anyway, the Australian singer last week, Altian Childs, put out a fascinating video where he says that the Freemasons have a massive... I mean, we've just been talking about the influence in big business and contract fraud and that sort of thing, infiltrating politics. But he talks about a lot of the Freemasons that he met before he decided to come out, I would say quite bravely, because he's basically ditched his career by doing this and possibly put his family at risk as well. He says that they're very, very big in the entertainment industry. And here's a little clip from his long 5-hour piece he's put up. He is a former X Factor winner in Australia, but he's decided that he needs to come out because he had an experience which convinced him that he had to come out to the public as a whistleblower against the Freemasons.
If you're an atheist, you're especially going to want to hear this. Christians and atheists are the most pathetic bunch in the eyes of this ancient religion, the one that rules them all. And I'm only going to show you the tip of the iceberg. And just like an iceberg, the full body of this secret religion continues down past the line of sight beneath the ocean. It widens in mass and scope until it continues further into the depths, into ever-increasing darkness and invisibility, until it reaches its foundations, which is firmly established in thick blackness, completely unimaginable and not perceived at all to those who only ever get to see its tip peeking out of the ocean top, including most of its members. At least 75%, 80. And unless you're a member of this religion and this secret society, as they call it, you won't be granted access to the world stage or of a position of influence. It's become a prerequisite for success now. Now that they've gained pretty much full control and their members are in every place of prominence and power. So brace yourself for the truth that has been hiding in plain sight every day of your life and for the mind-blowing out-of-this-world climax to this video. Now look at this. There's a few different ways they display their allegiance. They don't do it often and some don't do it at all. But most of them can't help themselves because when they do it in public, it's a hidden statement. And that statement gives them a lot of satisfaction. The celebrities usually cover one eye or hide it in some way and obscure it or emphasize it like this. Or they close one eye or peek through it through this hand gesture. All to highlight one single eye. It's called the all-seeing eye. Other times they'll just display a drawn eye somewhere or a tattoo of it. The other method they use, it's what's commonly known as the hidden hand. Here, for example, River Phoenix is doing both the hidden hand and the all-seeing eye. So you can see the direct connection between the two. But in the political world, usually it's done with the hidden hand. And of course, this. That's a secret handshake for the members of the secret one-eyed religion. We'll start with Scott Morrison here, hidden in plain sight as usual, for everyone to not see as usual. Look at the handshake. I was taught this very handshake, or grip as they call it, during my time in this great school of deception. Here's a picture of a normal handshake, and here's the secret handshake. normal, secret. Now here's Scott Morrison with Daniel Andrews. Normal handshake, secret handshake. All of them are sworn to secrecy under the penalty of death. And remember, I'll prove it to you very soon. Here's former Prime Minister John Howard giving the secret handshake and Kevin Rudd bowing down to this bloke in front of Julia Gillard, all of whom are members of the religion, and Tony Abbott, you'll see in a second, and he's Julia again. Now, I once heard Julia being asked in a brief interview on TV while she was the Prime Minister. The interviewer asked her, "What religion are you?" My ears pricked up as I was eating breakfast and I froze to hear the answer. And she actually said, with a sinister smirk, "I'm a member of a secret society. Next question, please." And what happened? Nothing. No one cared. No one cared that the person who represents them just confessed that she's a member of a secret society, when the Australian society is at large the only society that should matter. And why is it a secret in the first place? I'll show you. Very soon you'll know their beliefs and you'll know their master plan and you'll know why they take such extreme precautions with such hideous oaths of silence under the unbelievable penalties, including death, to stay hidden from the public. So what's the name of this religion? Well, I'll tell you right now. But keep in mind, the magic word you're about to hear only hides the true religion inside of itself. That's how it's secretly flourished to spread like a cancer around the world. It's a religion within a fraternity. The name of the international fraternity, the one that camouflages, conceals, and cloaks the secret religion inside it, is this: Freemasonry. This is their official symbol, the square and compass. Sometimes with a G in the middle, and sometimes with the eye, the all-seeing eye. This is the same eye that these people are referring to. That's where it comes from. The eye is sometimes placed in a triangle, and that's where this comes from, the eye in the triangle. Here's Chris Angel doing it, standing also next to a mate with a square and compass shirt on. Not a coincidence. This is not something Jay-Z invented. This is the religion Jay-Z belongs to, and proudly, as you're about to see. The Freemasons also place the eye at the top of a pyramid, because the Egyptian pyramid is integral to their secret system.
So that's Annie and Charles there. And before we hear from Martin on just a general thing about Freemasonry being a religion or like a religion, I thought we'd hear from another video, which was passed on to me by one of our listeners, which is about a chap who, it came out of Freemasonry. It's somebody, I mean, it's, the video is called Freedom from Freemasonry. He's a Scottish guy called Robert Brogan, who recently decided he'd had enough. And there was some pressure put on him from somebody visiting his family. And so he decided that it was probably a good idea just to leave it. And this is what happened.
My wife came to Spain on holiday. We had a holiday home, so she was able to come frequently. So she came for a week. And when she was here during that week, a mature Christian lady that you'd came to visit Pauline for supper one night. And whilst there, the conversation got round to the me being a Freemason. So this person knew about LL, had been there, and had knew that this wasn't right. And there and then told Pauline that she needed deliverance from being a wife of a Mason, that I needed prayer to be released from the workings of the devil, that I'd get a chance for all confusion to go, you know, that it would be bound and loose, that I would be able to get free. Mm-hmm. So they had a night of prayer. So my wife told me they had a night of prayer. And then after they were both exhausted with that, this person went home. And Pauline was lying at home in the apartment on her own that night. And while she would close her eyes, she actually had her first demonic supernatural experience when she saw, she tells me it was like flashing faces flying by her, like fiery eyes and fiery faces floating around the room. which she would manage to just pray off and get to sleep eventually. But that was the first demonic thing. Wow. But, so the next day, I was at work that day, the following day, whilst Pauline was on holiday. Mm. And so she phoned me or I phoned her. But anyway, the conversation went, you've got to get out. I've had a prayer. I've done all this. I've had all these prayers. I've seen these demons. What you're doing is wrong. And so even then, I'm saying to myself, it's rubbish. There's nothing wrong with Freemasonry. Head was sealed. It was burnt like a hot iron.
Mm.
And then the shutters were coming down. The ears were getting closed. The heart was getting hardened. And then she made me promise. She made me promise that you will have a look, won't you? Tell me you'll have a look to find out if any of it's true.
Mm.
Okay, that's fine. Anyway, I've got to go now. Bye. Phone down. So I had a thought to myself, and I said, that day was a God appointment, because that day, normally it was the two of us in the office. I was on my own. So I took advantage of it and online and had a look at forums and Freemasons, and I saw what was available. You know, Freemasons do this, they do for charity, they put money here, they do that. And then I thought, right, that's not really good enough. I wanted to know what do they actually know, what goes on. And so I then looked at some websites, and I got to some websites, and I went to three websites, one of them was the Isaiah 54.org, which I printed off there then,
yeah.
Which would have been, that would have been maybe 4 years ago. But from the three different renunciation prayers that I looked at, I was astonished at the depth of the truth that was in them. Mm. That what they, all these secrets that we're supposed to die on to the point of death and never reveal, and hello, they're out there. And if you're honest, they're there. So I thought, you know what, I'm gonna. I had looked at the three of them, and I didn't like them all as such. So I married the three together, just to make one for me that was conclusive.
Yeah.
So when I put it together, I said, you know what, I don't know why. I don't know why I did it. But I just did it. I started doing it. I started speaking it out, confessing with my mouth and believing with my heart that these things would come to some fruition. So I got halfway through the prayer, and then there was a knock at the door. The phone began to ring. People come in, so I was interrupted. And I had to go on a wee driving job it's only about 4 or 5 miles. So I had to go and do that. And now here, when I'm driving down the road, and it's a long straight road at this point, it sounds far-fetched, but it's the truth. It's like in the movies. When you see the cars coming towards you, right? And as they get towards you in your vision, the car seems to be slowing down, and the person in the driver's seat is looking at you, but they've got bug eyes, right? Bug eyes, and they're gnashing their teeth.
Mm.
And as the car passes by, the face stays fixed on me as it passes by.
Wow.
I thought, whoa, that's not right. What's this? So I must be dreaming. It can't be true. But no, it happened twice, and it happened three times. So it was as quick as I could do to get my job finished and get myself home, where I then shut the door, locked the door, switched the phones off, and I got my prayer. I went through it three times.
Hmm.
Did all the forgiveness, all the renunciation, all the removing of the curses and the putting on the blessings, all the removing of all the clothing that was from the Freemasons, hmm. and replacing it with the armor of God, and then thanking God and then having Him reveal to me what other things that may need to come off. And I did that three times. After the third time, I felt this huge relief. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, this whole weight has gone off me.
Wow, wow.
And it was the next day that my wife, Pauline, was due back. And, of course, she was a little bit anxious as to how was she going to persuade a stubborn mule like me, because really I was stubborn and stubborn. I was the person that you would have to drag their heels to get a pair of shoes, and the pavement would be in ruts. I wouldn't go. I'd be that stubborn. So she came in, and we're driving along, and there's a little bit of tension between us as we're driving. And we came to a set of traffic lights and put the handbrake on. And I just looked at it and I said, "You're right." He says, "You're absolutely right." And then we just opened the door to everything being back to the... That opened the door to the us have our relationship being proper. We got home, and then I think it was the next day or the day after that, everything that I had in the house, every part of my regalia, my father's regalia,
yeah.
the briefcase itself, mm-hmm. The jewels, the rings, the cuffs, everything that we had, we built a fire and we put it in.
Good.
And the last thing that we had was my father's King James Bible, Masonic Bible, in hardback blue Bible. And we ripped that up in bits and we put that in the flames. And we waited. It didn't burn. It wouldn't burn.
So, yeah, that's Robert Brogan, his story, Martin. I mean, there does seem to be a sort of spiritual aspect to this, doesn't there? This whole idea of, you know, kind of demonic forces. Do you believe in any of that? So Martin is not answering that one. I mean, it's a shame because I was hoping, because Martin, being an atheist, it would be quite interesting to have a discussion with him about that. I mean, you've got this interesting dilemma, an interesting problem, haven't you, in philosophy, in that, you know, how do you have free will? How do you give human beings free will if you believe in a God? Those human beings have to make... you have to give them the free will to do the wrong thing, to be evil, to be bad, to be selfish. Basically, that's what divides us, is we're either public-spirited or selfish. And, you know, so it's no point in giving people free will if they've only got the free will to do what God says. And so there's got to be this evil. It's almost essential, isn't it? I mean, ever since the Garden of Eden. But anyway, since Martin seems to have cried out, let's... crack on with the final piece. I think that's a fascinating one. I'll put obviously links up to these on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, particularly the Altian Childs. It's 5 hours long. But if you really want to get to the root of what's going on with Freemasonry, I suggest he's got a fascinating take. And you know, obviously these people could be making it up. Looking at it from my point of view, they don't seem to be at all. They seem to be very honest. And this is the sort of thing that you will not get shared anymore these days on the mass media. We did in the 1980s have a terrific series on ITV about the Freemasons done by Martin Short. I think it was called Inside the Brotherhood, something like a 6-part series all about the Masons. But you won't get that anymore. But what you will get is you'll get a series on Sky TV made by the Masons and pretending to be, this is exposing them. Well, of course, they're not going to expose themselves. All they do is just lie and put out their own propaganda. So, yeah, anyway, finally this week, because we've had a bit of a torturous show with a few technical problems earlier, but we're going to get round now to the Conspiracy Classics, number 8, I think it is, this week, and have a listen to a guy called Fritz Springmeier, because he goes up a level from all of this, really, to look at the elite societies around the world and what he calls tribes or families that have been controlling things, controlling wealth for generations. And let's see if I can find Fritz Springmeier. And his book is called The Bloodlines of the Illuminati.
The Illuminati is the continuation of the mystery religions. There was quite a number of mystery religions in antiquity, and these mystery religions had councils that controlled them, and then there was a supreme council that operated from India to the British Isles, that then coordinated all of these mystery religions, and that would be the today what we call the hierarchy of the Illuminati.
So the Illuminati is basically just an extension of the mystery religion system, the whole type of philosophy.
Yes, it was a way of hoarding knowledge and power to a few special people.
And how do they hoard the knowledge?
Well, when I say knowledge, some of the knowledge is pseudo-knowledge, and some of the knowledge is actually scientific knowledge, which enabled, for instance, Christopher Columbus to be certain that he could sail across crossed the Atlantic and hit land, he was associated with the Knights Templars, which is one of these secret societies associated with the Illuminati. So you've got different types of knowledge, but some of the knowledge is actually bogus. It's just claimed so that they can get people to join whatever mystery religion they're trying to offer.
Okay, Fritz. Now, why are families so important in this? It's obviously you titled it Bloodlines, and mm-hmm. that must have to do with the families. Why are they so important?
It has to do with how they pass power from one generation to another. It also involves the occult powers. They try to have full-blooded members. They believe that, at least the traditionalists within the Illuminati, which are the full-blooded members, they believe that to really be a powerful witch with all the occult powers that demonology gives you, that you have to be a full-blooded member who's got a genealogy that goes back many years.
So in effect, what you're talking about is basically generational Satanism.
Right, it's generational Satanism. And they have to operate also within bloodlines because of the way that they carry out their mind control. They make program DID, or what was commonly known for a couple hundred years as multiple personality disorder. They program their members with MPD, and in order to do that, you have to have someone who will disassociate when they're traumatized rather than die. There's three things you can do when you're severely traumatized. You can just curl up and die, or you can go crazy, or you can have the creativity and the disassociative abilities to splinter the mind into a multiple. And they want that ability. It's essential because the satanic rituals that they carry out, which are horrendous traditional rituals, blood sacrifices, requires a certain level of insanity and disassociative ability. In other words, what I'm getting at is if you were a normal, sane person and you had to participate in the higher level Illuminati rituals, you'd probably go crazy without without the programming and the MPD that they carry on. So the it's absolutely essential that they maintain the bloodlines.
Okay, Fritz, now when you talk about blood sacrifice, what do you mean? Are you talking about chickens or goats or something like that?
No. Unfortunately, I'm talking about human sacrifices. This is, you go throughout the world and you examine the different cultures, and you'll find that human sacrifice has been fairly widespread. And these powerful families have always felt that they gained power and through sacrificing other people.
So you're saying that the blood sacrifice that we've read or heard about throughout the history books has never actually stopped. It's just gone into secret.
That's right. Correct.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to immunologist, retired immunologist Danny Laham from Florida, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. To get onto my weekly email circulation list, do email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. If you want my book into looking into the connections between the Arnhem Battle and the Bilderberg conferences, and literally the two private secretaries to the two main leaders in World War II in Europe, that is Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann and Desmond Morton, respectively, Yeah, you can get that off my website, bilderberg.org, but don't try and share it on Facebook. Facebook won't allow anything from bilderberg.org to be shared. Apparently, it's a disinformation, misinformation website, and so the truth has turned on its head. So if you've got a site or a story you'd like us to share, think there's anything I've missed, or have a correction, please do email me with a list or a link or two, or even a scan of what you've got if possible. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. Do please make recordings of the stream, although maybe edit a bit out tonight because we had a few technical troubles. Live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is the norm in the UK today. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast over the weekend, do please credit this show to thisweek.org.uk. Let me know and we'll credit you here. Please do have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Well, on a brighter note,
commercial break.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Stop about every 1,000 miles, ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation. Breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are united states of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is a reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates, where bears in the woods are chased by Grecian formulated bald eagles. TV is mechanized politics, remote control over the masses, co-sponsored by environmentally safe gases. Watch for the PBS special. It's a perpetuation of the two-party system, where image takes precedence over wisdom, where soundbite politics are served to the fast food culture, where straight teeth in your mouth are more important than the words that come out of it. Race baiting is the way to get selected. Will he Horton or will he not get elected on television? The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
On the screen is an address where you can mail your tithe offering or gift of love.
Okay, got the idea? All right, brother, conscious.
Is it the reflector or the director? Does it imitate us or do we imitate it? Because a child watches 1,500 murders before he's 12 years old. And then we wonder why we created a Jason generation that learns to laugh rather than abhor the horde. TV is a place where armchair generals and quarterbacks can experience firsthand the excitement of video warfare as the theme song is sung in the background. Sugar sweet sitcoms that leave us with a bad actor taste, while pop stars metamorphosize into soda pop stars. You saw the video, you heard the soundtrack. Well, now go buy the soft drink. Well, the only cola that I support would be a Union COLA cost of living allowance on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. Back again, new and improved, we return to our irregularly programmed schedule, hidden cleverly between heavy-breasted beer and car commercials. CNN, ESPN, ABC, BCB, TNT, but mostly BS, where oxymoronic language like virtually spotless, fresh, frozen, light, yet filling, and military intelligence have become standard. TV is a place where phrases are redefined, like recession to necessary downturn, crude oil on a beach to moose, civilian death to collateral damages, and being killed by your own army is now called friendly fire. TV is a place where the pursuit of happiness has become the pursuit of trivia, where toothpaste and cars have become sex objects, where imagination is sucked out of children by a cathode ray nipple. TV is the only wet nurse that would create a cripple. Television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance, feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.